Matthew Mutchell. And that's all we've got time for this morning. I'm Kaz Graham. The programme is produced by Sarah Swadling, and Farming Today is a BBC Audio Bristol production.
On FM, on digital, on smart speakers and online, this is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Tuesday the 17th of February. This is Today with Nick Robinson and Anna Foster.
Good morning. The headlines today. Groups representing councils and local officials have warned they face a race against time and an uphill struggle after ministers reversed their decision to cancel elections in 30 councils in England this May. We'll be hearing from the government about how ministers justify that decision at around 7:30. President Trump says he'll be indirectly involved in talks between the US and Iran, which will take place in Geneva later.
Also in today's programme, the latest snapshot of the jobs market will be revealed in an hour's time. So where will it leave unemployment, and what does it mean for young job seekers in particular? The former Health Secretary Alan Milburn, who's investigating why so many young people are not in education, employment or training, will give us his view at 8:10. We know the risks, but are we ready for them? One of the world's leading AI pioneers joins us at 7:50. And
from all accounts, it's going to be the craziest football match I'm ever likely to see.
The beautiful game, but not quite as you know it. This is Shrovetide football, and it's a little bit different. More on that before 8 o'clock this morning. The BBC News is read by Charles Carroll.
A group representing election administrators has warned they face an uphill struggle to organise polling in 30 English councils affected by yesterday's dramatic government U-turn. Labour had backed delays to the May vote in these areas because of plans to reorganise local authorities. But yesterday, ministers reversed their stance in the face of a legal challenge brought by Reform UK. Opposition parties have criticised the government for chaos, but ministers say they're providing certainty to councils. Our political correspondent Damian Grammaticus reports.
In Norfolk, Suffolk, Blackburn, Lincoln, Thurrock and two dozen more parts of England, councils now have less than 3 months to be ready for May's elections. Some say they were still preparing anyway, aware there was a legal challenge to the government's decision to postpone votes in their areas. But Laura Locke from the Association of Election Administrators said they were now playing catch-up. There was little time to print ballots and organise staff and venues. The District Council's network said voters would be bewildered by the off and on again polls.
The Office for National Statistics will release the latest figures on unemployment and wages in the UK in an hour's time. In the last set of data, the rate of unemployment in the 3 months to November stood at 5.1%, the highest it's been since the pandemic. Annual wage growth slowed slightly over the same period to 4.5%. President Trump has said that he will be indirectly involved in talks between Iran and the US, which are due to take place in the Swiss city of Geneva. He described the discussions about the Iranian nuclear program as very important and added that he didn't think Tehran wanted the consequences of not making a deal. There's been a large American military build-up in the region, leading to speculation that the US is preparing to strike Iran. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, is reporting from Tehran on condition that none of her material is used on the BBC's Persian service. These restrictions apply to all international organizations operating in Iran.
Both American and Iranian negotiators say they want a deal. What's not clear is just how wide the gaps are between them. Iranian officials say they're ready to compromise as long as the US is ready to lift sanctions, now crippling Iran's economy. They're also adamant that these talks can focus only on their nuclear program, not on other issues, including ballistic missiles, which some senior US officials, as well as Israel, insist must be on the table. Iran believes it's now winning this argument, but President Trump continues to send conflicting signals. He often says he prefers to do a deal, but he recently remarked that regime change would be the best thing to happen in Iran.
The former US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who's due to give evidence to a congressional committee over the Epstein files later this month, has told the BBC that everyone who's asked to testify, including Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, should do so. Hillary Clinton says she doesn't recall ever meeting Epstein. Her husband, the former US President Bill Clinton, has denied any knowledge of the disgraced financier's crimes. Mr. Mountbatten Windsor has consistently denied any wrongdoing. Hillary Clinton was asked if the King's brother should give evidence by our correspondent Jessica Parker.
I think everybody should testify.
Look, including the former prince.
I think everybody should testify who is asked to testify. I just want it to be fair. I want everybody treated the same way.
Patients, their relatives and whistleblowers have described a culture of physical abuse and neglect at a mental health hospital in Northampton, where police are carrying out three separate investigations. The majority of the patients at St Andrew's Hospital, run by the mental health charity St Andrew's Healthcare, have been referred by the NHS. Matt Pressey reports.
A damning Care Quality Commission report in December described how inspectors had seen CCTV recordings showing staff at St Andrews kicking and hitting patients. 15 staff members have been arrested in the past 18 months. 10 remain on bail, facing a range of allegations including willful neglect and assault. One person's been arrested on suspicion of rape. St Andrews says it had reported its staff to the police and that an urgent action plan is in place to make improvements.
The BBC has found that thousands of NHS staff are being referred to debt collectors because of errors in payroll systems which have led to them receiving overpayments. Trade unions say not enough is being done to resolve the issues before bailiffs become involved, creating extra stress for health workers. Charlie Haynes reports.
We put in Freedom of Information requests to NHS trusts across the UK. Of the 142 that gave us comparable data, we found that while the number of overpayments has stayed roughly the same for the last 5 years, around 50,000, debt collection referrals have increased by close to 50% to 2,683. One doctor told us the first time he was made aware he'd been paid too much was when he received a court summons. NHS England says it has established a payroll improvement programme in response to our investigation.
Up to 50,000 people are gathering in Delhi for an international meeting on the future of artificial intelligence, which will consider how to ensure that it's safe. Our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman, is in Delhi.
There's huge excitement in India that it's hosting this fourth and largest annual global AI summit, the first having been held in the UK. Despite the pledges at previous events to maximise AI's benefits while minimising its risks, the tech continues to disrupt jobs, generate misinformation and raise concerns with the misuse of AI tools to create explicit deepfake images. Western countries are racing to lead the AI revolution, but there are concerns that low and middle income nations such as India, which have built the foundations for the AI giants, aren't reaping the same rewards.
And that was Zoe Kleinman.
Thank you, Charles. It's 7 minutes past six. Let's get the weather. Here's Ben Rich. Morning.
Morning, Anna. Thank you very much. And good morning to you. Today is going to be a pretty decent day, actually, for many parts of the UK. This is a window of mostly fine and mostly sunny weather. But that said, some places are starting on a cold, frosty and pretty icy start, particularly where there have been some wintry showers overnight. So I'm going to start across the north of the UK. So starting across Scotland, Northern Ireland, Northern England, down into Eastern England as well. Here, the risk of some ice first thing. So it could be some poor travelling conditions on untreated roads and pavements through the morning. Still a few wintry showers around as well, parts of Northern and Eastern Scotland. These falling mainly as snow, and down the eastern side of England, a few showers along the coast falling as a mix of rain, sleet and hill snow. But through the day, we will see some dry weather, some good spells of sunshine and temperatures generally around 4 to 6 degrees. Now for Wales, for the Midlands and for the southeast of England, here's some sunshine through the morning, but we will see more cloud rolling in from the west, initially turning that sunshine quite hazy, cloud then thickening up a little bit more through the afternoon, temperatures around 6 to 8 degrees. For the southwest of England, a sunny start, yes, but cloud will quickly be rolling in from the west, bringing some outbreaks of rain as we head through the late afternoon and into the evening, highs of around 8 or 9 degrees here. Now, this evening and tonight, the southwest of England will see some heavy rain, bit of rain into Wales as well, some rain and hill snow into parts of Northern Ireland, and then into tomorrow, southern and western parts of the UK will see some rain, but perhaps over high ground, a little bit of snow in the mix as well.
Thank you very much indeed, Ben. It is now 9 minutes past six. Let's take our first look at the morning papers. The government's decision to abandon plans to postpone local elections across 30 councils in England this May is the lead for many of the papers. The Mail describes what it says is Sir Keir's 14th major U-turn during his time in office as a new humiliation for the Prime Minister.
The Telegraph says it's heard from councillors and other local authority insiders who've spoken about the chaos, turmoil and the unnecessary race against time that they now face.
The Eye paper quotes one council leader as saying that local authorities are experiencing whiplash from changing government decisions, making it almost impossible to plan effectively for residents. It says the U-turn is triggering the next threat to Keir Starmer's leadership.
The Times describes as a watershed moment the fact that GP records can now be linked to the UK Biobank. This holds the data of 500,000 middle-aged Britons who signed up to give blood samples to the project more than 20 years ago. The paper says the link hadn't been possible before because of bureaucracy. It quotes researchers as saying that now NHS England has taken over the legal liability for the data. They'll be able to use it to understand what's really causing disease and to help them solve major health challenges.
The Guardian says that UK bank chiefs will hold a first meeting this week to discuss alternatives to Visa and MasterCard because of fears that President Trump has the ability to turn off US-owned payment systems. The paper reports that the meeting will bring together a group of city funders who will cover the cost of a new payments company to keep the UK economy going in case problems occur. The paper says the initiative, which would be government-backed, has been around for years, but that Donald Trump's recent threats against Greenland have raised concerns.
And many of the papers this morning carry photos of the Oscar-winning actor Robert Duvall, whose death was announced yesterday. He was 95 and best known for roles in films like The Godfather and Apocalypse Now. The Telegraph calls him a scene-stealing star. The Times says he was considered the quintessential thinking man's tough guy.
It is now 11 minutes past six.
Senior Ukrainian and Russian officials are meeting for talks in Geneva later via key US figures. James Waterhouse, our Ukraine correspondent, is there. Morning, James. Realistically, are we expecting anything to come of this?
Morning, Anna. Well, I don't think the conditions are favourable, let's put it like that. I mean, let's start with the Russian delegation. They're being led by a man called Vladimir Vedinsky, former culture minister, and the Ukrainians are no fans. He is seen as someone not senior enough to bring real change, but he's also been accused of lecturing the Ukrainians in the previous two rounds of talks that have involved parties from both sides. The shadow of the Munich Security Conference as well seems to be looming large. You have the US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, in his much anticipated speech. Yes, adopt a slightly softer tone with Europe, but did he mention Ukraine? Not once. He instead went to visit Robert Fico of Slovakia and Viktor Orban of Hungary, both allies of Russia. And then you have Volodymyr Zelensky himself. He looks especially exhausted last weekend, I thought. He was incredibly frank about these continued proposals for Ukraine to give up territory in return for a peace deal. He has been saying, look, we have compromised enough. And I can't quote him specifically, Anna, at this time of the morning, but he again told Russia where to go when it came to its continued occupation of his territory and what he sees as the lack of sanctions on Russia's nuclear companies, national nuclear companies, for example. Nevertheless, these talks are starting today. Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff of the US are engaging with the Iranians this morning, and the Ukrainians will have to wait their turn until this afternoon. But we don't know what will come out, what could pave the way towards some kind of pause in fighting.
Yeah, and I'm sure you'll be watching those talks closely for us. James, thank you. James Waterhouse there, our Ukraine correspondent.
13 minutes past six. California's governor and Donald Trump's most prominent critic, Gavin Newsom, was here in London yesterday to sign a deal with the UK government's Energy Secretary, Ed Miliband, to cooperate in the development of clean energy. Our climate editor, Justin Rowland, was watching what they've agreed, which is what, Justin?
Well, the agreement is to cooperate to help scale up Greek clean energy technologies, including offshore wind. It also talks about expanding access for British firms to California and vice versa, including the electricity company Octopus Energy. And also there was talk of boosting collaboration between research institutions on both sides of the Atlantic. This is being billed as the first clean power deal between California and the UK, although it frankly is also quite possibly the first ever such deal.
Yet for quite a long time, even when Arnold Schwarzenegger was governor of California, there were contacts between the British government, Tony Blair, I remember many years ago, dealing with Arnie over clean energy in the sense that there were shared interests in tackling climate change.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, California is a huge economy. It's had a long tradition of supporting climate action and clean energy. I think it stands as about the if it was a country, it would be the fourth largest economy in the world. So it is very important. It's also played a very important role in kind of regulating action in America because it's so big. The standards it imposes on, for example, cars and other vehicles have in the past been adopted nationwide in the US because it's such a huge market that to do anything different doesn't make sense for the car manufacturers. So it plays an outsized role in America, particularly in green technology, as you say.
An outsized role in Donald Trump's mind as well. It's hard to know whether he hates clean energy more than he hates Gavin Newsom or the other way around.
I know this was he was very, very critical in an interview with the political website Politico. He called the deal inappropriate. He said the UK's got enough trouble without getting involved with Gavin Newscum, which is his nickname for the Democratic governor of California. He said it was inappropriate for Newsom to make such agreements and also inappropriate for the UK to be dealing with him. Remember, Donald Trump calls climate change a hoax and climate action the new green scam. But I guess some of that will worry those in the UK government anxious about the relationship with Donald Trump when they see what he's saying about this deal that Ed Miliband struck with Gavin Newsom.
Justin Rowland, our climate editor, thank you.
It's 6:15. In about 45 minutes' time, we'll get more data that will give us a sense of what's going on in the jobs market. Will Baines here with more on that and the rest of the day's business news as well. Morning, Will.
Morning, Anna. Morning, Nick. Yes, this data from the ONS contains stats not just on wage growth, which the Bank of England in particular watches closely when it comes to interest rate decisions, but will also give us a look at what's going on with hiring and the number of vacancies for jobs employers have. It comes as Catherine Mann, one of the Bank of England's most senior officials, told The Telegraph at the weekend increases in the minimum wage had manifested in unemployment for young people. Well, Jack Meaning is with us. Jack is the UK Chief Executive at Barclays. And Sophie Huynh is also with us. Sophie, our markets guest this morning, the Portfolio Manager and Strategist at BNP Paribas Asset Management. Morning, both. Jack, first of all, feels like there's sort of two things going on, aren't there? One, what the Bank of England's watching in terms of that wage growth. But then on the flip side, the kind of wider health of the UK economy in terms of jobs and hiring.
Yeah, well, I think that's exactly right. I mean, we have been looking for wage growth to slow for a while now, not because it's a positive thing for the economy that people get lower wages, but because that will alleviate some of the inflationary pressure that the Bank of England are worried about. The difficulty they have is, as Catherine Mann said over the weekend, as the economy is slowing, what we've seen is the unemployment rate ticking up. We'd expect to see that continue today in today's data. We think it will go up to 5.2%. And actually, that's been on a steady rise now for the last 18 months at least.
And what's your sense about what is driving that? Because that is going to be one of the important questions, isn't it? Not just for the Bank of England, but also for the government.
Yeah, I think, partly it's the fact that economic growth has been relatively lackluster over the last kind of 12 to 18 months, and that manifests in fewer jobs being created. But also firms have had to absorb additional costs from things like national insurance contribution increases. And one way they can do that is to just not replace workers when they leave. They don't replace them back onto their headcount numbers. So that's been one thing that's fed through. But also, again, global domestic uncertainty in the economy and around the world just means that firms are a little bit less certain about hiring. I guess the more positive story comes from the fact that actually as firms are able to adopt new technologies such as AI, maybe that means it's better for them to pivot into a world in which they have slightly more capital, slightly more technology, and maybe a little fewer workers than they previously had.
Sophie, that's an interesting point, isn't it? Because Catherine Mann in that Telegraph piece clearly pointing to UK policy as one of the drivers that she's seeing for some of this, and yet the impact of AI perhaps having as significant an impact as well in terms of particularly hiring, and we've heard it a lot, haven't we, in graduate sectors, for example.
There's definitely some uncertainty. So if you look at the labour market, it's the same in the US where we're hyper-focusing on this. There's been signs of deterioration. The UK labour market has been losing momentum with the sustained slowdown feeling. But on the other side, if you look at activity indicators, it's really pointing towards like some kind of recovery, like the start of a mini cycle. So the question at this point is, how much emphasis do you want to put on the labor market versus potentially a more CapEx infrastructure-led economy going forward?
And Jack, what do you think that sort of means then more broadly?
For the economy, Will? For
yeah,
the Bank of
sorry.
England? Yeah. I mean, for the economy more broadly, I think, you know, there's a positive story that you can kind of look at the productivity numbers. There are some signs that actually productivity in the UK, which we've been needing to pick up for a while, is potentially on the turn. That will be very helpful, because essentially that means, you know, the living standards of people, the kind of the output per person starts to increase. So that's the positive. But obviously, if you're one of those people that's finding yourself in the unemployment statistics this morning, that's not a very good place for you to be.
Yeah, Sophie?
I'm just wondering, like, in terms of the impact of AI, it's clear that in the short term, the productivity boost could be here, but there's going to be a point where we don't know when, like it could be in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, where the productivity is going to start having an impact and bite back at us. So there's uncertainty on the timing, which is why there's this tremendous rotation on the equity market at this point.
And Jack, take us to the Bank of England then, as well, as you mentioned, then in terms of the interest rate decision that will be coming up. We've obviously got inflation later this week too. What in particular, I mean, is there a number you think would cause particular concern today, or in when it's sort of factoring into that?
I mean, I think all of the members of the Bank of England's committee have got what's happening with wage growth and unemployment at the front of their minds. I think if we see a step down in wage growth to something like 3.4% for private sector wages, that will mean they're on track for wage growth probably to be somewhere between 3 and 3.2% by the middle of the year. I think they'd be pretty happy with that. On the unemployment rate, they're expecting it over the next few months to tick up to 5.3%. As I said, we're expecting 5.2 today. So again, those kind of numbers will keep them on a path where they'll be comfortable cutting, we think, probably in March. Anything that's kind of lower than that on wages or higher than that on unemployment, and that will maybe start to ring a few alarm bells, I think, in Threadneedle Street.
Jack, thanks so much for your time this morning. Jack Meaning, UK Chief Economist at Barclays there. Or Sophie Hewn staying with us as well, as I say, from BNP Paribas. Let's turn to more companies news, Sophie. Topshop going to start appearing on people's high streets again, though not in its own standalone stores, inside John Lewis's this time.
Yeah, finally, after a return of a five-year absence. But I think there's two reads on that. The first one is the ongoing challenge that the UK retail sector is facing. So this difficult environment triggers partnership like this one, address consolidation, as we saw with Russell Bromley and Next. But I think it's part of what we discussed earlier, and the fact that department store want to revitalize their offering, but also attract younger customers that want this brick and mortar experience. So having Topshop in physical stores is really part of the strategy.
Yeah, interesting, isn't it, that it's been a trend online from some of those big players. You mentioned Next, M&S as well, sort of bringing other brands into their online offering. A shift here with, because it's not just Topshop, that John Lewis has done this with. It's Waterstones, the bookstore as well, that they're going to have some in as well. Interesting kind of shift in the kind of retail landscape, sort of all under one roof again, old-fashioned almost.
Yeah, it's trying to trigger productivity whenever you go shopping, I guess.
Yeah. Elsewhere, defence obviously been a big talking point through the weekend as well. What's it looked like for FTSE 100 defence companies? Sort of a bit of a rise for a whole bunch of them yesterday after the Prime Minister's comments.
No, it got a boost, but I think it's nothing new here. Defense spending have been much more at the forefront given this, you know, ongoing regionalization of the world, but also uncertainty about the survival of NATO. So, just to remind, they are considering bringing forward this 3% of GDP spending on defense to 2029. But I'm just wondering how much will be implemented and financed. But overall, yes, it will be positive for the finance companies for the UK.
Yeah, been a question mark that we've heard here on the programme from the likes of Leonardo, some of the big defence companies, about exactly that, isn't it? Sophie, thanks so much for your time. Sophie Hune, Portfolio Manager and Strategist at BNP Paribas Asset Management there. Now, shareholders for the parcel locker company InPost digesting a consortium buyout bid led by FedEx and private equity company Advent. InPost board has unanimously recommended the offer, which would value the Polish firm at a bit over £6.5 billion. That's 50% above its pre-offer share price. And so it's now up to investors, but they are not all convinced it's a great deal. Aberdeen Investments is one of them, and Matt Peacock is an analyst there who watches emerging market equities. Matt, morning. So you guys at Aberdeen are going to vote against this deal. Why?
Yeah, I think it'd be great to start just by, you know, explaining our conviction in InPost as a business. You know, we believe this is one of the most exciting logistics infrastructure stories of the last decade. It's pioneered lockers in Poland and is now scaling that proven model across Europe, including the UK. So its advantages are its network is larger, faster and more efficient than any competitor, giving it a structural advantage. And we believe that positions it well to compound value for many years. In terms of the offer itself, we're voting against the offer because we feel it materially undervalues that long-term growth potential. And equally, as stewards of our clients' capital, it's our duty to protect their long-term value. And we believe this offer falls short of what we believe InPost is worth. Digging a bit deeper, you know, we feel that the bid is rather opportunistic. The consortium is sort of seeking to capitalize on temporary share price weakness rather than providing an offer that reflects InPost's true fundamentals. And we're asking the board to rethink their process. We believe the board should reassess their decision-making process and ensure all shareholders, especially minorities such as us, are treated fairly throughout the process.
Is the challenge not that everybody has seen InPost's idea, thought, well, that looks good, and the likes of Amazon and plenty of others, and we've seen the Royal Mail doing it now as well, are all now in that space too, perhaps with deeper pockets?
I think it's a great point. And, you know, what I would suggest is actually competition has come as a function of InPost's success. They've been able to eat into established carriers' profit pools that are predominantly two-door operators, whereas InPost have an APM network that's far higher quality in terms of speed and reliability and is also able to deliver the same product at a lower cost than two-door.
So bluntly, you think this company can continue to grow on its own and that actually being kind of tied to a wider company like FedEx might actually be bad for us, bad for consumers?
Exactly. You know, I think this is, you know, a great example of why active management matters. You know, we're trying to ensure that board decisions are aligned with the long-term interests of all shareholders. And, you know, we want to continue to be long-term investors in what we believe is a structurally advantaged business.
Matt Peacock of Aberdeen Investments, thanks so much for your time.
Well, thank you very much indeed. Sad for those of us from Macclesfield. Garfie, tell us about this.
Yeah, 70 minutes, an excellent effort from Macclesfield, but the six-tier side, eventually they were denied a place in the fifth round of the FA Cup by an own goal against the Premier League's Brentford. The Brentford manager, Keith Andrews, was well aware of the danger posed by Macclesfield, who beat FA Cup holders Crystal Palace in the third round.
It was a game that was always going to be a real test for a lot of different reasons. I think they've got a really good spirit about how they play. They've obviously got confidence from the last round, which every man and his dog knows about. So it was never going to be easy. I thought in the first half we didn't help ourselves in some aspects. I didn't think we did the basics well enough. That's our second half. We did it very, very well.
Brentford will face West Ham next. The pick of the fixtures is League One side Mansfield Town hosting 14-time FA Cup winners Arsenal. The full FA Cup fifth round draw is on the BBC Sport website. A hat-trick from Hadji Wright sent Coventry City back to the top of the Championship with a 3-1 win over their rivals for promotion Middlesbrough. The Coventry City manager Frank Lampard is remaining cautious about their chances of returning to the Premier League.
The feeling in these last weeks, you know, everyone, when we were some points clear, was excited. I wasn't. I understood. I was happy because we were playing well, but I understood the duration of the season. And this has been a check for everybody, maybe not the worst, to get this feeling and understanding that this stadium needs to rock. We need to give energy. But there's a long way to go. So I'm not getting overly excited. I'm delighted with the boys tonight, but there's a long way to go. We need to take that forward.
It was heartbreak again for freestyle skier Kirsty Muir, who finished in fourth place for the second time at these Winter Olympics. Muir missed out on slopestyle bronze last week and yesterday was 3.5 points off claiming the bronze medal in the big air final.
I'm really proud of myself for putting the two tricks down that I did, and also going for it in that third run, because I'd never tried that, like landed that trick before, so I just had to go for it. And yes, I crashed out on the third one, but I'm still proud of myself.
Great Britain's men's curling team lost 8-6 to Norway, leaving their semi-final hopes in doubt. They face Canada and the United States, needing to make sure of a place in the last four. And Dave Ryding finished in 17th place in his fifth and final Winter Olympics. At cricket's T20 World Cup, England had another scare in the group stage. After a final ball finish against Nepal, they eventually beat Italy yesterday by 24 runs. Australia's hopes of reaching the Super 8 stage of the competition now depend on other results after they were defeated by 8 wickets by Sri Lanka. And Scotland face Nepal this morning at 1:30. There's commentary on BBC Sounds and Five Sports Extra.
Thank you, Cathy. Let's take a moment to look ahead to Sunday.
The strong should give to the weak, and the strong should shoulder the weak.
In the run-up to Easter, 6 personal reflections on power, inspired by the story of Jesus' passion.
Jesus does not save the world by proving who deserves mercy. He saves it by giving mercy freely.
Thoughtful voices exploring faith, life, and what power means in the world today. Lent Talks on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds starts on Sunday evening at 7:45.
Time now is 6:30. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson. And Charles Carroll has a summary of the news.
A group representing election administrators has warned they face an uphill struggle to organise polling in 30 English councils which were affected by yesterday's government U-turn. Labour had backed delays to the May vote in these areas because of plans to reorganise local authorities. But yesterday, ministers reversed their stance in the face of a legal challenge brought by Reform UK. The Office for National Statistics will release the latest figures on unemployment and wages in the UK in an hour's time. In the last set of data, the rate of unemployment in the 3 months to November stood at 5.1%, the highest it's been since the pandemic. Annual wage growth slowed slightly over the same period to 4.5%. President Trump has said that he will be indirectly involved in talks between Iran and the US, which are due to take place in the Swiss city of Geneva. He described the discussions about the Iranian nuclear program as very important and added that he didn't think Tehran wanted the consequences of not making a deal. The former US Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, has told the BBC that everyone who is asked to testify, including Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, should do so. Hillary Clinton says that she doesn't recall ever meeting the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Mr. Mountbatten Windsor has consistently denied any wrongdoing. The BBC has found that thousands of NHS staff are being referred to debt collectors because errors in the payroll system have led to them receiving overpayments. Trade unions say not enough is being done to resolve the issues before bailiffs become involved, creating extra stress for health workers. NHS England says it has established a payroll improvement programme since the BBC's investigation. And up to 50,000 people are gathering in Delhi for an international meeting on the future of artificial intelligence. US tech bosses and world leaders are also attending the AI Impact Summit for talks about the technology's safety and its regulation.
Thank you, Charles. More on that AI summit coming up in a minute. First, though, at 28 minutes to 7, holding elections for so-called zombie councils, councils about to be abolished in a local government reorganisation, would, we were told, be pointless. Costly, time-consuming. That at least is what the Secretary of State for Local Government said to justify his decision to delay elections in 30 councils for more than 650 councillors. Well, at least he said it until yesterday, and when he reversed his decision in yet another government U-turn. Joe Pike, our political correspondent, joined us. Is he getting the blame? And if not him, who is, Joe?
Partly ministers are getting the blame, Nick, because public endorsements of delays before the full announcements were made may have weakened their case. Partly, I think the lawyers are being blamed too. Of course, they're not able to answer back. Now, government sources won't go into detail about the shift in legal advice, but clearly the outlook ministers like Steve Reid were presented with was bleak. They knew they'd likely lose. From my conversations with those involved, they sound downbeat, they sound bruised, they sound a little annoyed, but carrying out this humiliating 180, and it has been humiliating, may have been a little less painful than the alternative, a high-profile day in court, your argument being picked apart, maybe a judge making blunt conclusions. I'm told the picture became clear in government, the penny dropped in government last week, and those in government knew the painful headlines and the opposition glee was coming. And it's also notable and frustrating for journalists that the announcement was slipped out yesterday afternoon once the Prime Minister and his team were back in their departments away from the microphones and cameras. And there was nobody in government put out yesterday to explain all of this. That is really rather rare, although it will, of course, change today because the Care Minister, Stephen Kinnock, is facing questions from broadcasters, including on this programme.
We'll be talking to him at about 7:30. There are no ministers in the House of Commons today because the House of Commons is on its half-term break. Now, when you say the opposition are cock-a-hoop, it's really Reform UK, Nigel Farage's party. They brought the legal challenge. I imagine there are politicians, not just in the Labour Party, but in the Tories too, who are a bit anxious about the electoral consequence of this.
Absolutely. As you said earlier, Nick, the argument was why hold elections for councils that may not exist in a year or two, and elections are expensive. But clearly there was also a clear political advantage for Labour in particular, even if those in government are pretty loath to admit it, because let's say you are a Labour Prime Minister facing difficult elections in May, the results of which could lead to your job being challenged. Wouldn't it be rather helpful not to face some of those elections? Of the 30 councils we're talking about, Labour effectively control 21. Reform have their eyes on Thurrock and Basildon, I'm sure, and some of the Lancashire councils. But you mentioned the Tories too. There are dangers for Kemi Badenoch's party. If we look to Suffolk and Norfolk, usually Tory strongholds, we saw last May what happened in an area north of there in Lincolnshire that went towards Reform. Could the same happen this time? As for Reform's call for the man responsible for this U-turn, the Community Secretary Steve Reid, to resign, one government source has told me, and apologies if this triggers you, Nick, quotes, "No, we're not Manchester United. It's not like we're having one managerial resignation a month."
Enough of that. Joe Pike, thank you very much indeed.
It is 7:24. One of the world's biggest AI summits is happening in India this week. Zoe Kleiman, our technology editor, will be there. For Zoe, the first of these gatherings that's happening in the Global South.
Yeah, that's right. It's really interesting to see what happens in terms of the tone of this conference, because lots of Indian workers have been involved in training the data that the big AI products are using, the big AI tools that hundreds of millions of us are now using all the time. But they don't work in all of India's official languages. There are 22 of them, and most of them work in about half. So I think there's a sense that while India does have a thriving tech force, it's also been, you know, been used to build the foundations, if you like, of this AI empire and isn't necessarily reaping the same level of rewards. The sheer scale of this summit is breathtaking, Anna, both physically and in terms of its content. There are thousands of people travelling to Delhi to attend. I've also heard local companies are bringing along scores of rural workers to join the action. The conference centre is the size of 70 football pitches, and I think every square metre is going to be put to good use, because India's really hoping that this event will let it flex its muscles as an AI power. There's also dozens of panels, discussions and keynote speeches taking place. Loads of researchers, academics, professionals, some household names, Joshua Bengio, one of the AI godfathers, Bill Gates, Google boss Sundar Pichai. We think they're all going to be there. Ambassadors from around the world, including, we think, from China. And there are also seven themes, or chakras, as India's calling them. And they cover everything from the billion-dollar question about AI governance and safety to issues like accessibility and climate. Some delegates have told me privately they're a bit worried that this event is so big that it's going to be difficult to actually come to any meaningful conclusions about anything, while others are really hoping that there will be some impact in India this week, because let's face it, we've had three of these summits now. We've seen lots of talk, lots of grand declarations, but we've still got lots of problems, haven't we? There are concerns about AI's impact on big issues like jobs and cybersecurity, and that's certainly not gone away.
Zoe Kleiman, our technology editor, thank you. Worth saying, by the way, Professor Joshua Bengio, who she mentioned there, one of the three godfathers of AI, as they're known, is making a keynote speech. I've been talking to him this morning, and you can hear what he's got to say at 7:50. It's quite a bleak assessment of some of the risks and dangers that AI poses, and the fact that we, and governments in particular, are not getting to grips with them as quickly as we need to.
Yes, you came out of that recording rather shocked.
I really was. It's honestly, and he is somebody who knows exactly what he's talking about. And the warnings that he's making now may well be quite prescient. So, 10 to 8 to hear that.
Other material will cheer you up, I promise. Now, it is 21 minutes now to 7 o'clock. We turn now to a story which highlights, I'm afraid, the grim reality of life in Ukraine 4 years on from Russia's full-scale invasion. There's a state-funded programme up and running that allows soldiers to store their sperm for free to help them have a child in future. The reason, of course, is that the war has injured or killed hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian soldiers. So that service, sperm freezing, is increasingly popular, including, in particular, for those heading to the front who want to leave their partner the option of having a child if they're killed. Our East European correspondent Sarah Rainsford sent this report from Ukraine.
Hi, Maxime. Yes. I'm Sarah. Добрый день.
Hello, my name is Max.
The other day, I called Maxime on the front line somewhere in eastern Ukraine because the soldier wanted to talk about his sperm.
Can I ask you, Maxime, why you decided to freeze your sperm?
Ukraine's gene pool is dying. Our men are dying. It's about the survival of our nation.
Maxime is one of a growing number of Ukrainian soldiers who've been freezing their sperm samples for free before being deployed to fight. He told me it's because if he's killed, his wife could still have the child they both want. And if he does survive this war, he's worried about his future fertility.
There's no guarantee you're safe, whether you're on the front line or even 80 kilometres back.
Maxime means because of the Russian drones overhead, constantly hunting.
That means stress, and that has an impact on a man's fertility. So we have to think about the future, and the future of our Ukrainian nation.
Since Russia's full-scale invasion 4 years ago, Ukraine's birth rate has dropped dramatically. I met baby Bogdan when he was just a day old, his tiny face all wrinkled and pink. But Oksana, the director at the clinic in Kyiv, tells me she now sees far fewer Bogdans, only half the number of pregnancies she saw before the war. That's partly because so many women fled as refugees, and those still here don't want to have so many babies in a land of missile strikes and air raids. But Oksana says it's also about fertility. She confirms that's badly affected by stress. So, in the lab, her colleague pulls long glass tubes of frozen sperm from a vat to show me. The clinic now stores these samples for soldiers, frozen while everything's still strong and healthy, and then kept for the future, just in case.
Cuckoo!
That's how Natalia now has baby Yura, scooting around her living room in a stroller.
He's such an interesting little guy, and he looks so much like his father. It's like a second Yuri was born.
Yuri's dad was killed fighting, and Natalia conceived months later through IVF, using her husband's stored sperm, as they'd agreed, but as she'd hoped would never happen.
He wanted a son so much.
At first, the sperm storage program for soldiers was only to be used if they were injured and unable to have children. It was altered later so the samples could be used after a soldier's death, because so many have been dying here.
I will tell him everything when he is old enough to understand. I will tell him that his father is a Ukrainian hero.
Oksana Dmitrieva is an MP who drafted Ukraine's law on sperm storage and is still ironing out some of the problems, like stopping a dead soldier's parents from claiming his frozen sperm if his widow doesn't want to get pregnant. The MP is also busy spreading the word among soldiers.
I go to the front a lot and I talk to the soldiers there about freezing their sperm. At first, they are really embarrassed, but I tell them about it, and I tell them to tell others. No one knows what will happen in the future. So if they have this chance, why not? It doesn't hurt.
The soldier I spoke to up on the front line really hopes others follow his lead. For him personally, he says, it's peace of mind, knowing that if all of this ever ends and he does make it home, he has more chance of having a child one day. That's one problem I don't need to worry about any longer, Maxime tells me. And when you're out here in the East, that's really important.
Sarah Rainsford reporting there from Ukraine. It's now 16 minutes to 7. It's a vital job, but a harrowing one. The job of undercover officers infiltrating the darkest corners of the internet to rescue children who are being abused. A BBC Eye investigation has followed US special agents from Homeland Security who worked with agents in the UK to rescue a 12-year-old girl who'd been abused for 6 years. That is the backdrop to tonight's Storyville on BBC Four. It is inevitably distressing. We can discuss what was going on in that film with one of the agents featured, Pete Manning, special agent from Homeland Security Investigations, who joined us in the Today studio. Welcome to you. And alongside him, Alex Brobney, who's only just met in the last 24 hours, who does a similar job, not undercover, but for Surrey Police, where she's an online child abuse investigator. Welcome to you, Alex, as well.
Thank you.
Pete, tell us about this work, because the film focuses in particular, as I mentioned, on this 12-year-old girl. And people may be amazed to learn that it is sometimes quite apparently trivial details that allow you to find a suspect.
Yeah, thank you for having us. So the nature of the dark web is that the artifacts that you will get from these cases are virtually anonymous. So because the fact that this network doesn't have an IP address that you can trace back to an address or a business or a person, we are left with only the images and videos that we find. And it's sometimes those very small details in these images, like a light switch or a water bottle.
Or in a case that we see in the film, bricks, the type of bricks in a wall.
Yes. So in this case, there, we had spent years looking for this one girl and poring over images that we were picking every detail about furniture and toys and other things. And we just got down to a brick wall behind this girl, and we reached out for help to an industry that specializes in bricks, and hoping that somebody would know like specifics about where that brick came from.
And that's what you got. You got basically going and saying this is an unusual brick. It's in a particular location in the US. But even so, that doesn't get you to a house.
Yeah. And it's, you know, we ask for sales records. What we would normally do is say, you know, how would this get us closer? And what we got back was you can't, except for the fact that bricks are heavy and they can only travel a certain amount of place from where they were made.
So it's that sort of puzzle. Alex, I know you were recently involved in saving a child of just six. Is it that sort of jigsaw puzzle, that sort of almost Sherlock Holmesian type of puzzle that you're having to solve often?
Yeah, it's exactly that. As Pete says, we, you know, initially we were sent a video, which was only a very small clip. We had very small sort of clues to work from. And that's why collaboration is just so important, because there was just a small few of us around the world. So I worked with agents like Pete. We all picked apart, you know, pieces of the images to try and work out if there was anything we could identify.
And we often hear of the horrors of AI. We're going to hear some of the dangers later.
Yes.
But AI presumably
can
also be a huge help in processing a lot of information very quickly.
Massively. And it helped us in this case as well. And from saving that child abroad, it actually led us to a dark web offender in the UK. So, again, that actually shows how important it is to collaborate and for us all to work together to, you know, bring these children to safety and the offenders to justice.
And Pete, does AI also give you some sort of protection? Because I think people listening, and indeed, as I knew I was about to meet you, think, how do these guys do this job, seeing these horrific images?
It does. I mean, so instead of having to sort through millions and millions of photos, we can categorize them now better with some AI technology that allows the examiner to not have to view so many.
Yeah. And that is something that makes this a tolerable job, is it, for you?
It's that, and the mission of us saving children. You know, we put our own traumas aside because what we feel doesn't come close to that of a child that's being sexually abused. So we push through because we have an end goal, and that is to save a child's life.
So day to day, what is the scale of this cooperation? Pete, you've done this programme with the BBC. Was it up until now something that didn't happen very much, or has it always been cooperation across the globe?
It's something that we've had since I started, is that this tight network of a small group of people worldwide that I can pick up the phone and call anybody in any country, any law enforcement agency. And if you're working these type of cases, you know you're going to get an answer to that call.
Mm. Mm.
Yeah, very much the same. Ever since I started, we've collaborated and we share any information we can to get to the end result.
And do you find yourself immensely frustrated that tech companies are not helping you, not giving you the information that you might need?
It can be frustrating. There are some that are very good, and that that's what their goal is, to protect children. It's a constant challenge because we have to tell them about the dangers and remind them that kids are on this platform.
Alex? Mm.
Yeah, very much echoing what Pete says. It's incredibly frustrating, but we have people that will assist, but it's rare.
But lastly, there is hope.
Oh, absolutely, there's hope. There's always somebody out there.
Pete Manning, Special Agent, Homeland Security Investigations, Alex Bromley of Surrey Police, thank you. And you can watch that documentary on Storyville tonight, 10 p.m, BBC 4, iPlayer already, and listen to a podcast related to it called World of Secrets, The Darkest Web on BBC Sounds.
It is 10 to 7 now. The Royal British Legion is planning a major national event in May to mark 15 years since the end of the war in Iraq. It will honour the 179 British service personnel who were killed and also the thousands of others who still live to this day with the impact of their deployments. Mark Atkinson joins us, Director General of the Royal British Legion. Good morning.
Good morning.
I actually deployed, well, three times I embedded with British troops in Iraq and got to see the difficult and dangerous and important job that they did. And I know that one thing that you're finding now is that many of those people, for a long time, they haven't really sought the support that they needed. And now some of them are starting to do that, which is great news.
I think that's right. So often we do find that it's many years after the conflict has ended that people come forward looking for help and support. And we know that many people that deployed in Optelec, the war in Iraq, suffered long-term physical and psychological trauma. And people often experience delay in seeking help. So part of this event on the 22nd of May is about commemoration, but it's also about support and making sure that everybody's getting the support they need, even 15 years after the end of that conflict.
In many ways as well, it feels so long ago. And do you find that people sometimes feel that the impact and that their contribution can be forgotten now?
Well, I mean, I think everybody that served in Iraq should feel incredibly proud of their service. The British forces made an incredible difference there, both in terms of their combat operations in southern Iraq, in Basra, but also the stabilization and security operations that happened, the provision of humanitarian aid and support. So it is a long time ago. It was a long conflict, obviously starting in March 2003, ending in May 2011. So it's 15 years since the end of Optelec. But I do hope that everybody that served feels incredibly proud of their service. And what we want to do on the 22nd of May, which will be the 15th anniversary since the end of the war in Iraq, is to commemorate the service of everybody that contributed to that conflict. But also, as you said in your introduction, in particular to acknowledge the 179 British personnel who lost their lives, and the nearly 6,000 British personnel who were injured, many with life-changing conditions, both physically and psychologically.
And one thing, as you say again, which is important for people like that, is to see those moments marked. As you know, as I said to you, it is a long time ago, but often in society, particularly when it's a country that is, you know, so far away, it can be easy for those contributions to be forgotten, not for the people who were involved, but for us, for society as a whole.
I agree. And I think, you know, throughout the Royal British Legion's history, we've been charged with leading the nation in remembrance and making sure that people remember the service and the sacrifice of our armed forces. And of course, we do that each November, but we also try to do it around the key anniversaries. And so I remember speaking to you, Anna, last year as we marked VE Day and the 80th anniversary of the end of the Second World War in Europe. We did the same in December of last year to mark the 30th anniversary of the end of the war in Bosnia, and the year before, the 10th anniversary of the end of combat operations in Afghanistan. And I do think it's important that as well as a nation coming together each November to remember, that we do recognise each of those key anniversaries. And so that's why we'll be remembering Optelic in Iraq 15 this coming May. And I'd really encourage anyone who's listening to your programme to go to the RBL website today and to register to come along and be with us on the 22nd of May at the National Memorial Arboretum. So whether you served there, whether your family member served there, whether you're connected to that conflict through bereavement, through the loss of a loved one, we really want everybody to be with us at this big flagship event that we're planning.
Yeah, Mark Atkinson, Director General of the Royal British Legion. Thank you very much indeed. It is 6 minutes to seven now. The National Police Chiefs Council is setting up a new national group to try and help police forces who are assessing allegations that have come from the publication of the Epstein files. Dal Babu is a former Chief Superintendent in the Metropolitan Police. Good morning.
Good morning, Anna.
What kind of support is this group going to offer? Because presumably for individual forces to be dealing with something like this, it helps to have a unifying body that you can get a bit of advice from.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have 43 forces in England and Wales. We have the PSNI in Northern Ireland and then Police Scotland. It's unclear where Jeffrey Epstein, the paedophile who wasn't convicted, and Maxwell, who was convicted, where they went with the aid and help of the former Prince Andrew. So with perhaps 45 locations, it's important that there isn't blue on blue and there's a coordinated opportunity for the police to talk to each other to understand who will be investigating which matter. And I think it's really important that the police are absolutely open and transparent. And they're very, very clear, because there is so many concerns from survivors that there is being a cover-up by the establishment. So it's really important that it's really open, transparent, and very, very clear that there'll be a full and proper investigation into whether it's Mandelson or Andrew or anybody else who's been complicit in these issues.
And important for survivors to hear that as well, because as you say there, this involves the royal family, it involves government, it involves organisations which in some cases can be difficult for law enforcement to deal with, and presumably an extra level of support will help with that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is in many ways a very, very significant moment for the royal family, because I think if you look at, I don't think it's any exaggeration to look at the abdication or Princess Diana moment, I mean, this is a real concern. And the public will want to know that, that there is no cover-up from anybody. And the royal family are now being seen in a very, very different way. If you recall, when Queen Elizabeth II died, there was a heckling of Prince Andrew. And the heckler got punched to the ground and roughed up. I don't think we're in that situation now. We are seeing heckling, we are seeing comments being made to the royal family. They'll want to make sure that they are seen to be helping and assisting in any way. And I think Andrew's reputation is in tatters, and the royal family really need to really make sure that they don't allow this to seep into other members of the family.
Dal Babu, a former chief superintendent with the Metropolitan Police, thank you. Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor, as you know, has continued to deny involvement in the crimes of Jeffrey Epstein, as has Peter Mandelson, who was mentioned in that interview as well. But interesting, as we were saying there, that unifying group is being set up by police to try and assist them in those really wide-ranging investigations. So many files, millions of files that they're now working through and working through those allegations, as we were saying. It is 3 minutes to seven.
I'm no longer ravenous. I'm no longer desperate. I'll no longer eat until I fall asleep and I have to rest.
The Hunger Game, a new five-part series exploring the meteoric rise of weight loss drugs.
It's been an incredible story with these drugs. The uptake, the amount of product that's been sold, the amount of money it's cost, the amount of money that's been made.
What the drugs do, how they work, and the knock-on effects of their widespread use.
People are having to completely alter the way they do business.
The Hunger Game with me, Professor Giles Yeo, from BBC Radio 4. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
Let's check the weather. Here's Ben Rich. Morning.
Thank you very much, Anna. Morning to you. Actually, not a bad-looking day ahead of us. Some spells of sunshine, but it is quite a cold start. Temperatures in many parts of the country have fallen close to or below freezing. And so, across Northern Ireland, Scotland, Northern England, down into Eastern England as well, we do have the risk of ice on untreated surfaces through this morning. So do bear that in mind if you're heading out over the next hour or two. Still some wintry showers as well across northern and eastern parts of Scotland. Falling mainly as snow here. And down the eastern side of England, down the east coast, some showers, a mix of rain, sleet and hill snow. But we will see some good spells of sunshine across these areas through the day. Temperatures generally around 4 to 6 degrees. Now for Wales, for the Midlands and for the southeast of England, a mostly sunny start to the day. And we will hold on to some sunny spells through the day, although more cloud will roll in from the west, initially turning that sunshine quite hazy and then that cloud thickening up a little bit by the end of the afternoon. Temperatures around 6 to 8 degrees. For the southwest of England, it's a little bit different. Some sunny spells through this morning, but cloud thickening quite quickly and some outbreaks of heavy rain arriving as we go through the afternoon. Highs of 8 or 9 degrees. Now, during tonight, we will see further rain across the southwest of England, far southwest of Wales, a bit of rain into Northern Ireland as well. And we do have the chance for rain and a bit of hill snow in southern and western parts of the UK tomorrow.
Thank you, Ben. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Anna Foster. Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Tuesday, the 17th of February. The headlines: councillors and election officials have warned they face a race against time and an uphill struggle after a government U-turn led to its scrapping delays to local elections in 30 areas of England. Figures showing the rate of unemployment and wage growth are due out shortly. And President Trump says he'll be indirectly involved in the talks between American officials and Iran about the country's nuclear programme, which take place in Geneva later today. Coming up in the next hour, we know the risks, but are we ready for them? One of the global pioneers of artificial intelligence gives us his assessment.
We're seeing these systems willing to be deceptive, even to blackmail an engineer so that they would not be shut down.
We'll hear from one of the organisers of Shrovetide football, a pancake day tradition that dates back to the 1660s. And an age-old rivalry takes centre stage. Why the battle between Oasis and Blur has now been turned into a play. The BBC News is read by Charles Carroll.
A group representing election administrators has warned they face an uphill struggle to organise polling in 30 English councils affected by yesterday's dramatic government U-turn. Labour had backed delays to the May vote in these areas because of plans to reorganise local authorities, but yesterday ministers reversed their stance in the face of a legal challenge brought by Reform UK. Opposition parties have warned of chaos, but the government says that it's providing certainty to councils. Our political correspondent Damien Grammaticus reports.
In Norfolk, Suffolk, Blackburn, Lincoln, Thurrock and two dozen more parts of England, councils now have less than 3 months to be ready for May's elections. Some say they were still preparing anyway, aware there was a legal challenge to the government's decision to postpone votes in their areas. But Laura Locke from the Association of Election Administrators said they were now playing catch-up. There was little time to print ballots and organise staff and venues. The District Council's network said voters would be bewildered by the off-and-on-again polls. East Sussex Council warned it already faced a huge additional workload preparing for imminent local government reorganisation that will see some councils abolished and merged. And the added demand of organising elections would strain its resources. But even greater than the organisational challenge will be the political test the government now faces with the vote on May the 7th.
The Care Minister, Stephen Kinnock, told this programme it wasn't the case that the government was postponing elections it thought it might lose.
We went out to consultation with the local authorities that were going to go through these changes, which, by the way, hugely streamlining, increasing efficiency, better value for the taxpayer. That's why we were doing it. 30 of them came back and said, they were just going to really struggle to make this make the elections happen whilst also doing the reorganisation. Those were both Labour-controlled councils, Tory-controlled councils, Lib Dem and Green and others.
And you can hear the full interview with Stephen Kinnock at 7:30. President Trump has said that he will be indirectly involved in talks between Iran and the US, which are due to take place in the Swiss city of Geneva. He described the discussions about the Iranian nuclear program as very important and added that he didn't think Tehran wanted the consequences of not making a deal. There's been a large American military build-up in the region, prompting speculation the US could carry out a strike against Iran. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, is reporting from Tehran on condition that none of her material is used on the BBC's Persian service. These restrictions apply to all international organizations operating in Iran.
Both American and Iranian negotiators say they want a deal. What's not clear is just how wide the gaps are between them. Iranian officials say they're ready to compromise as long as the US is ready to lift sanctions, now crippling Iran's economy. They're also adamant that these talks can focus only on their nuclear program, not on other issues, including ballistic missiles, which some senior US officials, as well as Israel, insist must be on the table. Iran believes it's now winning this argument, but President Trump continues to send conflicting signals. He often says he prefers to do a deal, but he recently remarked that regime change would be the best thing to happen in Iran.
The latest employment figures have just been published by the Office for National Statistics. They show the rate of unemployment in the UK in the 3 months to December rose slightly to 5.2%. Annual wage growth, excluding bonuses over the same period, fell to 4.2%, the lowest in 5 years. The former American Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, has said that she believes anyone asked to testify in the US about their links to the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, including Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, should give evidence. The former prince has consistently denied wrongdoing. Hillary Clinton was speaking in Berlin to our correspondent Jessica Parker.
Bill and Hillary Clinton are set to testify in the congressional investigation into Epstein later this month. If the pair hadn't agreed, they faced being found in contempt of Congress. The former US president, Bill Clinton, has denied any knowledge of Epstein's crimes from when they knew each other decades ago, while Hillary Clinton says she doesn't recall ever meeting Epstein. Andrew Mountbatten Windsor has faced calls to answer questions from US lawmakers. I asked the former Secretary of State if she thought he should testify.
I think everybody should testify.
Look, including the former prince.
I think everybody should testify who is asked to testify. I just want it to be fair. I want everybody treated the same way.
Because he's not a US citizen, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor can't be compelled to give evidence. He has strenuously denied allegations that he sexually abused the late Virginia Giuffre, a prominent Epstein accuser.
Patients, their relatives and whistleblowers have described a culture of physical abuse and neglect at a mental health hospital in Northampton, where police are carrying out 3 separate investigations. The majority of the patients at St Andrew's Hospital, run by the mental health charity St Andrew's Healthcare, have been referred there by the NHS. Matt Precy reports.
A damning Care Quality Commission report in December described how inspectors had seen CCTV recordings showing staff at St Andrews kicking and hitting patients. 15 staff members have been arrested in the past 18 months. 10 remain on bail, facing a range of allegations including willful neglect and assault. One person's been arrested on suspicion of rape. St Andrews says it had reported its staff to the police and that an urgent action plan is in place to make improvements.
Up to 50,000 people are gathering in Delhi for an international meeting on the future of artificial intelligence, which will consider how to ensure that it's safe. Our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman, is in Delhi.
There's huge excitement in India that it's hosting this 4th and largest annual global AI summit, the first having been held in the UK. Despite the pledges at previous events to maximise AI's benefits while minimising its risks, the tech continues to disrupt jobs, generate misinformation and raise concerns with the misuse of AI tools to create explicit deepfake images. Western countries are racing to lead the AI revolution, but there are concerns that low and middle income nations, such as India, which have built the foundations for the AI giants, aren't reaping the same rewards.
Royal Mail has been given 2 weeks to respond to allegations that it's prioritising parcel deliveries over letters, causing delays across the postal network. In a letter to the company, the Commons Business and Trade Committee has asked for commitments to improve a situation it describes as chaos. Our business reporter Peter Ruddick has the details.
Hundreds of people, including Royal Mail workers, have told the BBC of their concerns about the postal system. Some allege that overstretched workers are prioritising parcels over letters, leading to backlogs. Letters are then being delivered in batches, so some important correspondence is arriving late. In a letter to the company, the MPs have raised significant concerns about reports of service failures that go beyond normal seasonal pressures. Royal Mail said it understood the frustration when post didn't arrive as expected, but it was working to resolve some short-term disruption.
At the Winter Olympics, there was disappointment for Team GB's freestyle skier Kirsty Muir, who picked up her second fourth-place finish of the Games last night. Competing in the Big Air, she scored a combined 174.75 points from her best two runs, 3.5 points shy of Italian bronze medalist Flora Tabanelli. Last week, the 21-year-old narrowly missed out on a slopestyle medal.
Thank you, Charles. It's 9 minutes past seven. The latest employment figures have just been published in the last few minutes, as you heard in the bulletin there. But let me remind you of them. Unemployment rose slightly to 5.2% from 5.1%. And annual wage growth fell to 4.2%, the lowest in 5 years. That is down a little from 4.4%. So let's discuss what that means with Liz McEwen from the Office for National Statistics. She's the Director of Economic Statistics. Good morning.
Good morning.
What are you gleaning from those figures?
Well, we saw continued signs of weakness in the labour market as 2025 drew to a close. So the number of workers on payroll fell in that last quarter. That reflects weak hiring activity. Although in the latest month, it was actually largely unchanged. As you said, the unemployment rate increased on the quarter, and we saw there are more people who are out of work now looking for jobs. And as vacancies remained broadly stable over the period, we also saw the number of unemployed people for every vacancy increase, and that's now reached a post-pandemic high. The other thing we've seen is redundancies also seeing an upward trend.
There are some interesting things to look at regarding pay as well, aren't there? Public sector pay is going up a lot faster than private sector pay.
So there is with wage growth. So let's look at that. Overall wage growth eased, so for regular pay, from 4.4% to 4.2%. Regular pay is when we exclude bonuses from the figures. The difference between private and public sector pay. So private sector pay at the moment is at its lowest for 5 years. That's down from 3.6% to 3.4%. What's happening on the public sector pay growth? That remains elevated at the moment. It fell from 7.9% to 7.2%. Those figures are affected by earlier implementation of some pay awards in 2025 compared to 2024. We've seen that effect start to diminish. So there's an elevation in those figures to be aware of.
And what about when we take inflation into account, CPI? What does that tell us?
Yeah, so when we take that into account and we strip out those inflation figures, then we see what we call real earnings growth. That's also fallen on the basic measure as well. And that measure is important, of course, for households and their consumption abilities.
Liz McEwen, thank you for joining us from the Office for National Statistics. Michael Stoll is with us as well, Managing Director of Manpower Group UK. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, thank you. I hope you are too. What are those numbers telling you? Because obviously you're seeing payrolls live in your own company. Do those figures chime with what you'd expect to see?
Sure. And when we look at the ONS numbers, we really look at four different figures that come out. The unemployment levels, the participation rates, that really tells us the health of the market overall in terms of supply and demand. We know it was a tough end of the year, a lot of uncertainty in the market, a lot of economic headwinds, hiring managers, companies don't like that uncertainty, workers don't like the uncertainty, they stay put. So we knew that there was going to be a drop in hiring as we finished off the year. As we enter the year, we're starting to see some stability. So we're encouraged with what we have seen through the start of the year. The other piece that we looked at, and I know you touched upon this, is the wage inflation and the youth employment levels. I think both of these really kind of show the impact of government policy, the minimum wages, the employment rights bill. You have AI starting to come into the hiring market and impact the levels of hiring. And then we still have talent shortages as well. And so you're seeing in the wage inflation, all of these come into fruition. It's starting to ease as the market continues to deteriorate, but it's still positive and it's still pushing employers from a cost perspective. And the brunt of this is taken in the new jobs, the entry-level jobs, the youth jobs, and that's still very high and very concerning for us as we look at the youth employment levels.
Yeah, what are businesses telling you about their intentions and about their confidence in the market, what they're planning to do over the next 12 months and beyond?
Employers really like certainty. Flexibility always is helpful. Investment from the government is also very helpful, but certainty is first and foremost. And if we can get a couple of months, a couple of quarters of certainty, employers want to hire. And there's a lot of backlog. There's a lot of need in terms of investment around AI, around robotics. And so there is a big pent-up demand. And if we can just get that confidence back in, which will be developed through the stability within the marketplace, you'll start to see some positive traction within the employment market.
Michael Stoll, the Managing Director of Manpower Group UK, thank you.
Thank you.
It's coming up to 7:15. Incidentally, Alan Milburn, former Health Secretary under Tony Blair, who's running a review into the so-called NEETs, not in education, employment or training, and has warned of a lost generation, will be with us in about an hour's time to discuss what can and should now be done. Let's turn, though, now at 7:15 to the talks that are taking place that are so vital between the United States and Iran. Both sides continuing to flex their military muscles as their negotiators prepare to sit down for talks in Geneva. Talking to reporters aboard a noisy Air Force One overnight, Donald Trump was asked whether a deal with Iran was, quotes, next to impossible.
No, I think they want to make a deal. I don't think they want the consequences of not making a deal. They want to make a deal.
They don't want the consequences of not making a deal. Well, our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, is still in Iran, in its capital, Tehran. She's there on condition that none of the material she broadcasts is used on the BBC's Persian service. And morning to you, Lise. It's not just Donald Trump that's been talking. It's Iran's foreign minister tweeting about what Iran is prepared to do or not.
Both sides are making it absolutely clear they are ready to talk, that they prefer a deal, but they're equally prepared for war. You've just been mentioning President Trump warning of consequences. He's repeatedly told Iran that it would pay a price much bigger than the 12-day war last year with Israel, which drew in the United States, if it doesn't do a deal. There's been that military buildup, which continues apace in the Arabian Sea. And also yesterday, Iran elite Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps carried out naval drills in that strategic waterway, the Strait of Hormuz. So both of them signal that as their diplomats go into that room in Geneva, there'll be separate rooms in direct talks. They're prepared for the worst if this doesn't succeed. But I have to say, Nick, that in the last 48 hours, the language has shifted a little bit. Yesterday, we heard from Iran saying that they believe the Americans are, they use the word, realistic. Even Marco Rubio, the U.S. Secretary of State, who's tended to be quite hawkish on these talks, said there is an opportunity for diplomacy. For Iran, the only way that can happen is if this is a narrow deal, just about the nuclear program. Will President Trump be happy, at least in this first phase, to do that? we should have some clarity soon.
Interestingly, the foreign minister tweeted, and you interviewed the deputy just a couple of days ago, that he was in Geneva with, quote, real ideas to achieve a fair and equitable deal. What is not on the table, he said, is submission before threats. The question, I guess, for you in Iran, Lise, is what would they regard as submission? What can't they give, in their own minds at least?
This is also something which has changed, because bear in mind that even though there's been the last round of talks was on February 6th, so days past, in that period, messages were exchanged between many capitals. The leaders in the Gulf with whom President Trump has such close relations, including Qatar, have been on the phone to President Trump repeatedly, warning him about the consequences of a wider regional war. They've been working out kind of proposals. And we heard from the deputy foreign minister, who's one of the top negotiators next to the foreign minister, that they're ready to discuss compromises. So they're discussing diluting that uranium enriched now to 60%. That's really dangerously close to weapons grade. Even the possibility that they could suspend, not stop, for them that is the surrender that the Arab Foreign Minister Araghchi talked about, or at least alluded to in his tweet, but they would suspend nuclear enrichment. Of course, let's be realistic. That because of the damage done to their nuclear program and last year's war, they're not really doing much enrichment now. So it would be an easy give for Iran to do that. So there are compromises in the mix. Will the United States agree to lift some of the sanctions? Remember, those sanctions are not just strangling Iran's economy. They also sparked that extraordinary wave of protests last month, which were put down with extraordinary force.
Lise Doucette in Tehran. Thank you.
It's 19 minutes past seven. One of the key steps in the push towards net zero is reducing the emissions that are produced by the many trucks and lorries that deliver goods on our roads. So some new stats this morning from the Society of Motor Manufacturers and Traders present a bit of a mixed picture on that, Will, don't they?
They do, Anna, yeah. This is the SMMT finding that registrations for new electric heavy good vehicles rose last year, but that still just one in 70 newly registered trucks was an EV. Mike Hawes is the chief exec of the Society of Motor Manufacturers and Traders. Mike, morning.
Morning, Will.
Is that a fair description then, sort of mixed picture?
Yes, it is. I mean, the number of electric trucks registered last year actually doubled, but it still only represents about one in 70 of trucks that were registered yesterday. So we've got a huge distance to go, because the policy is we've got to have all new trucks zero emission that are sold by 2040, and that's only 15. It's like 14 years away.
Well, yeah. As a result, how realistic is that?
It's going to be a challenge. I mean,
it's going to be more than a challenge, isn't it? If it's a percent at the moment, and it's going to be 100%, it's a monumental challenge.
Yeah, and it's, you know, what we saw with the car industry when the first sort of mainstream electric car was launched about 15 years ago, and we're now it's sitting at about 25%. So you see how long this takes. The key issue for trucks, though, is, you know, it's about, you know, the operators know down to a pence, a half a pence per mile, how much it's going to cost for them to do a delivery, to do an operation. Once that cost is beneficial in terms of electrification, then the switch can happen quickly. For that, however, you need to get the cost of the trucks down. We need to get the cost of energy down so it's more comparable to diesel. And you need to get the infrastructure there, because it's woefully short at the moment.
I was going to say, is that where the acceleration really needs to come, of the controllables, I guess, from a policy perspective?
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, we talk about, there's, you know, some very, very generous grants there at the moment for truck purchases. But one of the biggest obstacles is, you know, you can't run a truck unless you can charge it from your depot. So you need to get those grid connections. And for some of them, you know, people are quoted, you know, 10 years for delivery. You also need to get the road network, the charging network on the roads improved. The number of dedicated truck charging is probably less than 10. It's in single figures. But also, we've got to think about all options. It's not just about electrification. Hydrogen might be part of that future. And we don't have a hydrogen network in the UK. And if you want to keep all options open, because the enemy here is carbon, think about hydrogen as well.
Mike, thanks so much for your time this morning. Mike Hawes, the Chief Exec of the Society of Motor Manufacturers and Traders.
Will, thank you very much indeed. 22 minutes past seven now. It was one of the most famous chart battles of all time, Blur versus Oasis. Back in 1995, Country House by Blur was released on the same day as Roll With It by Oasis, in a clashed build as South v North, posh v working class. Now this head-to-head has been adapted into a play called The Battle. It's opening at the Birmingham Rep Theatre tonight, and our entertainment correspondent Colin Patterson is speaking to the cast at one of the final technical rehearsals. Lives in a house, very
big house in the country. 1995. You gotta roll with it, you gotta take it. Blur, The Oasis for the number one single. So big that it made the main TV news bulletins.
Two of Britain's most popular pop groups have begun the biggest chart war in 30 years.
With a report by Clive Myrie.
In one corner, four young middle-class men from the south of England, collectively known as Blur. And in the other corner, five young working-class men from Manchester, called Oasis.
So we said, Broadway, let's put that on. How about the week before the new Blur single?
Now, more than 30 years later, and the events have been turned into a play called The Battle at the Birmingham Rep, with actors who weren't even born at the time.
Nowhere near.
No.
2004.
That's George Usher, who plays Liam Gallagher.
I think the great thing about this play is that younger lads that maybe wouldn't come to the theatre in like their Oasis gear coming to watch, which is such a special thing, because like where I grew up there wasn't much theatre culture.
I hear you sold out My Leg.
I think so, yeah.
Oscar Lloyd plays Blur's Damon Albarn.
It's nuts because it's 30 years ago, but it kind of feels like a period piece. You know, we're doing a lot of these sort of party scenes. No one's got a phone and everyone's kind of locked into this shared atmosphere, and maybe the hedonism of the time is maybe a little bit different, where I feel like we're all quite censored, maybe a bit more nowadays, of what we say and what we do.
What Blur did was a great gesture. And I want to go on record and say it's us and them against the world now.
The Battle has been written by John Niven, who in 1995 had just started to work for London Records, where he passed on the chance to sign a couple of rather big groups.
I didn't pursue, shall we say, signing Coldplay or Muse back in the day when I was a very bad A&R guy. My reaction at the time was, do we really need another kind of sub-Radiohead band? And the answer was yes, we did, very much did.
He does, however, have his own link to Oasis. He was the man who discovered Mike Flower's Pops, who had the Christmas number 2 that year, with an easy listening version of Wonderwall. Happy, the word on the street,
that the fire in your heart is out. I think Noel probably quite a nice publishing cheque that Christmas off the back of that.
And Niven believes that the Blur v Oasis battle is perfect material for the stage.
It occurred to me that there might be a really funny play, like a sort of sub-David Mamet play of men screaming at each other in hot rooms about something that when you pull the camera back is just ridiculous. Because ultimately, who cares which one of these records is number one, really? But I thought if we could invest it with Cuban Missile Crisis sort of stakes, then that's automatically going to be comedic.
It's not two of their greatest songs, is it?
There's that as a factor, but it's also, I think, in a bigger sense, this is what the play's about. It's, men, especially in their 20s, are all sharp teeth and claws and ambition and hustling and wanting to get where they want to be. And that results in things like this, you know. I think there's no one, Damon, are friends now. I think as men get into the 40s and 50s, that all calms down a little, you know.
At least one of the casts was their first time around. Gavin and Stacey's Matthew Horne plays Andy Ross, the boss of Blur's record company.
I'd seen the announcement about the play. I just felt disappointment that I was far too old to play any of the members of either band.
Because there would have been a time when you'd have been going for
it. There would have been a time, yeah. But that's 20 years ago.
Over the years, you cross paths with the bands at all?
I've met them all, actually. The person I've probably socialised with the most is Liam. He is a gent and incredibly funny.
Do you think he'll come and see it?
I hope he will, but he now lives in a big country house, doesn't he, in the Cotswolds? So maybe that's a little bit too far for him to come.
Well, if Liam does need persuading, at the first few preview shows, the theatre's bars reported what are believed to be record takings.
Colin Patterson reporting on the great battle between Oasis and Blur. Meantime, other battles, sport, Garfield.
It was a great battle for about 70 minutes, which was pretty impressive by Macclesfield of the National League North, the sixth tier of the football pyramid, but they made things tricky for Brentford until a Sam Heathcote own goal gave Brentford a 1-0 win. It is the Premier League side then that moves into the fifth round of the FA Cup, where they will face West Ham, and there's a full FA Cup fifth round draw on the BBC Sport website. Now, the T20 World Cup, England had another scare, but eventually beat Italy by 24 runs yesterday. They have qualified for the Super 8 stage. We can speak to Henry Moran, part of the TMS team, who is at Eden Gardens. Henry, hello.
Good morning from just outside the stadium, Cathy.
It sounds like it's already getting quite busy there. What's the biggest concern for England from that performance against a lower-ranked side like Italy?
Well, I think two elements stand out and have stood out all tournament. That's that top-order players are failing to go on and make those big scores. That's a real concern, particularly with the tougher tests that are to come in this tournament. Joss Butler, he's struggled to really get going. Harry Brook, the captain, similarly, not really finding rhythm. I mean, whether perhaps it's the sheer depth of England's batting being a little bit of a mixed blessing. I mean, that's one argument that those near the top of the order are failing to seize that responsibility, knowing that others can potentially bail them out. And it's all well and good as long as they then do with the ball. I think the real concern is that England's spinners have struggled in conditions that should typically suit them. Adil Rashid, outstanding against the West Indies, but otherwise has struggled. And a worrying statistic, only Oman's spin attack has been more expensive in the tournament than England's. That is a concern.
Yeah. Yeah, that is. England in the group stage, as you mentioned, they had a final ball finish against Nepal. They were defeated by West Indies. They had a wobble against Scotland. Those aren't really convincing results, but does that matter now that they're into the last eight?
Well, the primary job was qualification. They've done that. And how many times have we seen England sides in any sport make it through a tournament trying to find a perfect performance? The successes for England's cricketers in 2019, 2022, there were real wobbles. But it was the ultimate outcome that was the key in those instances. It will theoretically be tougher in the Super 8. They're going to be playing teams like Sri Lanka, New Zealand. But these players are actually much more familiar to England. So it could help them to be up against opponents they know a little bit better than the likes of Italy, Scotland and Nepal, who they came a little unstuck against.
Yeah, they did. And just finally, and briefly if possible, Australia's hopes of reaching the Super 8 stage depend on other results now. They were defeated by Sri Lanka by 8 wickets. How much of a surprise is that?
A big surprise, but they are missing key players. Cummins, Hazelwood, Stark, that bowling attack, all absent. But for them to sneak through it is going to take a challenge. They now need Zimbabwe to lose both of their matches against Ireland, who they face in a couple of hours, and then against Sri Lanka. They then themselves need to defeat Oman. So they're very much on the brink.
They are indeed. Henry Moran and the Test Match Special Team are over on Five Sports Extra. Thanks, Henry. He mentioned that match. Ireland, Zimbabwe at 9:30. Scotland face Nepal this afternoon at 1:30. There's commentary of that. Scotland already out of the T20 World Cup, though. And just a few headlines from the Winter Olympics yesterday. Freestyle skier Kirsty Muir finished in fourth place for the second time at these Winter Olympics in the Big Air final yesterday. And Great Britain's men's curling team lost 8-6 to Norway, leaving their semi-final hopes in doubt.
Thank you very much indeed, Cathy. I was just pausing a minute's silence for Macclesfield.
For Macclesfield, yes. Yes, they might have taken your photo out of that pub.
Yeah, or turned it to the wall, having let them down. Moving on swiftly. On Friday on Radio 4, Alan Davis pops by.
What would happen if something fundamental, like salt, sleep, or even rats, suddenly disappeared from the world? No warning, no explanation, just gone. Now what? What's the immediate fallout? How does society cope? And how long would it take before things start to really unravel? Life Without, with me, Alan Davis, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Friday afternoons at 2:45.
The weather this morning will be dry with light winds and plenty of winter sunshine. There'll be cloud this afternoon, but it should stay dry. I feel the should there is doing an amount of heavy lifting. Yes. It should stay dry, but don't blame us if it doesn't.
Yeah, well, blame Anna, but don't blame the people who write the weather. Coming up in the next 20 minutes on the programme, we know the risks. Are we ready for them? One of the global pioneers of AI, artificial intelligence, gives us his assessment.
You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Anna Foster. It's 29 minutes to 8. Charles Carroll has a summary of the news.
The latest figures for the rate of unemployment issued this morning show that it rose slightly to 5.2% in the 3 months to December, up from 5.1%. Annual wage growth, excluding bonuses, fell during the same period to 4.2% compared with 4.7%. A group representing election administrators has warned that they face an uphill struggle to organise polling in 30 English councils affected by yesterday's government U-turn. Labour had backed delays to the May vote in these areas because of plans to reorganise local authorities, but yesterday ministers reversed their stance in the face of a legal challenge brought by Reform UK. The Care Minister, Stephen Kinnock, has told this programme that the change in the government's legal position wasn't ideal. You can hear the full interview with him shortly. President Trump has said that he will be indirectly involved in talks between Iran and the US, which are due to take place in Geneva. He described the discussions about the Iranian nuclear programme as very important and added that he didn't think Tehran wanted the consequences of not making a deal. There's been a large American military build-up in the region, prompting speculation the US could carry out a strike against Iran. The former American Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, has said that she believes anyone asked to testify in the US about their links to the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, including Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, should give evidence. Hillary Clinton says she doesn't recall ever meeting Epstein. The former prince has consistently denied wrongdoing. And Royal Mail has been given 2 weeks to respond to allegations that it's prioritising parcel deliveries over letters, causing delays across the postal network. The company said it understood the frustration when post didn't arrive as expected, but it was working to resolve some short-term disruption.
Thank you, Charles. It's now 27 minutes to 8. Pointless, costly, time-consuming. That is how the local government secretary, Steve Reid, described the idea of holding elections in England this May for what he called short-lived zombie councils. Councils, in other words, that are about to be abolished in a local government reorganisation. He said all that until, that is, yesterday, when he reversed his decision to delay elections in 30 councils for more than 650 councillors and reveals that lawyers had warned ministers they risk losing a court challenge from Reform UK if they didn't make yet another U-turn. So far, with Parliament on its half-term break, there has only been a written statement from ministers. We would, of course, like to talk to Mr. Reid. He is not available. But this morning, it fell to the Care Minister, Stephen Kinnock, to try to explain what's going on. He's got an important announcement that we will come to. But when I spoke to him a few minutes ago, I began by suggesting the government had been caught red-handed trying to postpone elections they feared they'd lose.
No, we went out to consultation with the local authorities that were going to go through these changes, which, by the way, hugely streamlining, increasing efficiency, better value for the taxpayer. That's why we were doing it. 30 of them came back and said they were just going to really struggle to make this make the elections happen whilst also doing the reorganisation. Those were both Labour-controlled councils, Tory-controlled councils, Lib Dem and Green and others. And we went ahead, therefore, and said, right, we won't have elections in those places because we've got to be sensible and pragmatic about what's possible. We have now received legal advice to say that we can't do that. And so the decision to postpone has been withdrawn. We've acted on that legal advice. But throughout this process, the focus has been on getting more efficient public services, better value for the taxpayer, and doing it in a way that wouldn't put intolerable pressure on local authorities to do the reorganisation and do the local elections at the same time.
It's a bit of a nerve to blame local councils for a decision of a government minister. It was the government that decided these elections should be or could be postponed. It was the government that changed the law to do so. It was the government that fought in court until the very last minute. And your own MP, Labour MP Florence Eshalomi, who chairs the local government committee of the House of Commons, says democracy is not an inefficiency that should be cut out. You were warned and you ignored the warnings.
Well, of course, we have 63 of the local authorities affected by this, and some said they would be fine with it, but 30 said that they would struggle, and we listened to that and have acted to try to support them. And of course,
you know, but you didn't listen to the Electoral Commission. The chief exec of the body that's in charge of elections said scheduled elections should go ahead as planned. As a rule, we do not think capacity constraints are a legitimate reason for delaying long planned elections. You consistently ignored the advice.
We always act in the best interests of the taxpayer and what is feasible and practical, but we also always follow legal advice. And in this case, the legal advice has concluded that we couldn't go ahead with postponing them. And so we've listened to that and we're taking the appropriate action. But throughout this process, we've been focused on getting the best possible services streamlined, efficient. So there are over a third of people in the country, one in three people are currently in two local authority areas. There's a lot of confusion about which tier of local government is responsible for what. Two local chief executives, two finance managers, you know, all sorts of inefficiencies and duplications. So the focus has been on getting a better and more transparent and accountable service. And I think in 2 to 3 years' time, when we've gone through this reorganisation, people will really see and feel the benefits of
that. How on earth is it in the best interests of the British taxpayer to pay for Nigel Farage's legal bills because he did something that was going to be judged illegal in court?
I'm definitely not pretending that the change in the legal position is ideal. You know, it's just not. And we hold our hands up and recognise that we had a piece of legal advice, and then things have changed, and we are now in a position where we're having to withdraw the original decision. That's
so
not ideal.
So politicians blaming
not
the lawyers?
It is. Excuse me, sorry?
Are politicians blaming the lawyers?
No, not at all. We had a process that we went through, and then that changed. I mean, you know, I'm a government minister. There's many pieces of advice I get that have legal advice attached to them. You take certain decisions based on the advice before you. Sometimes circumstances change and you have to change your position. That's just the nature of the beast. That is what it means to be in government. It's about taking the right choices, which have to both be anchored in legality, but are also what is best for the British taxpayer. Deliver the best possible services.
Doesn't it insult our listeners' intelligence to pretend that this was anything other than what it was? An attempt by Labour ministers to postpone inconvenient elections that you look set to lose because the opinion polls are against you.
No, it was a process of consultation with local authorities who said they were really going to struggle to make this happen. And that's why we've made £63 million available to actually facilitate this now and enable the changes to take place. There is also the key point around these zombie local authorities where you could potentially have had elections in May 2026 only to go through a reorganisation and have to have a completely different configuration and then have to have more elections in May 2027.
So if I can get hold of Steve Reed's WhatsApp messages,
look at that and say, is that really a good use of time and all
sure.
resources?
If I could get hold of the Secretary of State's WhatsApp messages, if I could put him on a truth drug, you're saying that never would it have crossed his lips or been written in a text, great, we're not going to have votes in places that we're going to lose to Reform UK.
I know Steve Reed well, and he is a guy that's always up for having a good democratic debate and
testing
public opinion in the ballot box. So I do not believe at any moment that that was the issue. What he's also a guy is who's totally focused on getting best value for money for the taxpayer. He's focused on renters reform. He's focused on driving through the Pride in Place programme. He's focused on bulldozing red tape so that we can get our planning regulations in a place that's Steve Reed is the man I know.
We're delighted to have you on, and we'll talk about care in just a second. But shouldn't he be here now justifying why millions of pounds of taxpayers' money has been wasted? Why, in the words of the local government information unit, he's been playing fast and loose with the foundations of democracy?
Well, I'm not Steve Reed's diary manager, so I'm not going to comment on what he's doing this morning, but I'm delighted to be here in Bristol in Paul's Place, which is a hub for supporting disabled people, to announce a 7% increase in the minimum income guarantee for disabled people. It's the biggest increase in a decade. It's going to enable people to be left with a lot more of their savings once they've their costs have gone out to cover the costs of their care. And it's a real step forward in terms of supporting disabled people with the cost of living. And that's combined with £723 million for the Disabled Facilities Grant, which is all about home adaptations, helping people to live with dignity and respect and independence in their own homes. So very proud as the Minister for Care today to be making these announcements.
As I understand it, that big grant of payments is actually rather lower than it was last year when it was 761 million. But there is a real increase in the amount of money that people can keep. You have increased the amount of money they people can keep if they are dependent on this Disabled Facilities Grant. People will be familiar with this. But this is effectively the income that you can keep after you've paid all the costs.
Yes, exactly. So if you are, let's say you're a 30-year-old adult living with disabilities, you receive personal independence payments, universal credit, the local authority does an assessment of your care costs, and those costs are charged using your PIP and your universal credit. There is a statutory requirement that you are left with a certain amount per week as a minimum income guarantee that you use for your household bills, other living costs, other essentials. What we are doing today is uplifting that minimum by 7%, the biggest uplift in a decade. And that will be a statutory uplift. We'll be passing secondary legislation on this very shortly. And local authorities will then, when they do the financial planning and assessment for the disabled person, that is the minimum that they must be guaranteed. And this will benefit 150,000 adults across the country.
Stephen Kinnett, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks.
Now, it is just coming round to 17 minutes to eight. We were talking on the programme yesterday, and in fact, we have been for a few weeks or months now, about student loans, whether or not they are still the investment that students expected them to be when they signed up for university courses, and particularly that they're becoming more and more expensive. We heard from one former student who's been paying off her loan for years, and she actually owes more now than she did at the beginning. We spoke to Lord Willetts, the former universities minister, who was responsible for the creation of this, essentially, at the time. And one thing he did tell us on the programme yesterday was that he thinks that the measure of calculation, RPI, which was used at the time, which is now outdated, should be replaced by CPI to at least try and ease things a little. Paul Johnson's with us, the former director of the IFS, now senior advisor at Frontier Economics, and also involved with Queen's College Oxford as well. Paul, good morning.
Good morning.
Just remind us in a really simple way, I think if you're right in the middle of this, if you've got one of these loans, it makes perfect sense. But if you haven't, it perhaps doesn't. So how did we get here?
Well, I think we're now talking about the Plan 2 loans, which are the ones that were that ended in 2023 or introduced in 2011. We got here because governments were looking to reduce the cost of the public purse of providing higher education. We started off with loans from 2011 of £9,000 a year to pay for that education, for the higher education. Now, that's only gone up a couple of times in line with inflation. So both the amount of money that goes to university and indeed the effective real amount that students are paying off is less than it was if you graduated in 2022. It's a smaller number in real terms than if you graduated a decade before that. And the way the loans were designed was to look a bit like a tax, if truth be told. So you pay 9% of your salary above a threshold for 30 years for most people, unless you're earning enough to pay it off. And actually only a minority would pay it off over that 30-year period.
You said that was interesting when you said a tax, as truth be told, because when we look back at education over the last few decades, it used to be grants and then it became loans. And a lot of people just aren't familiar with this idea of this notion of there being a tax on education.
Well, yes, I mean, it's formally a loan, but particularly for these Plan 2 graduates, it looks very much like a tax. It looks like a tax in this sense that for most higher earners, they pay back quite a lot more than they borrowed because quite high interest rates, which go to RPI plus 3 for higher earners. And if you're a lower earner, you pay back quite a lot less than you borrowed because it's written off after 30 years and you don't start paying until you're earning over about 28,000 £5. So it looks like a sort of progressive kind of tax. Now, it's worth saying under the new system, under the people who've graduated in the last couple of years, looks a bit more like a loan, because actually most people pay back the same amount. They pay back what they borrowed, and it's not the case under the new system that higher earners pay back much more than lower earners.
Just as a final brief thought, Paul, when you know, we look at this from the point of view of students, but if we look at it from the point of view of the government and the government's debt pile, is this something that you think they will be looking at more when it comes to things like student finance to actually offset that?
Well, we know that they're looking at it because the Chancellor changed the system back in the budget. I think it's one of the things that really irritates graduates unreasonably, which is that they're told that what they've got is a loan, but the government can change the payback mechanism whenever it wants to. And the Chancellor effectively cut in real terms the point at which you start to pay back your student loan. Again, this is for the pre-2023 system. And the reason she did that is that that looks like a £5 billion boost to the public finances, because take in or count the additional money that she'll get over the next 30 years from these students, from these graduates.
Yeah, so may well continue looking in that direction. It's interesting, isn't it? Paul Johnson, thank you very much.
Time now is 12 minutes to 8, and it's time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is Vishwapani, a member of the Triratna Buddhist Order.
Good morning. The worse the news gets, the closer we come to some underlying questions. Epstein, Ukraine, climate change, geopolitics, you name it. What should we do? How can we not feel powerless in the face of so many problems? One answer, which people often associate with Buddhists, is to withdraw. The world just keeps spinning. Buddhists call it samsara. So perhaps the best we can do is to cultivate an alternative, at least within ourselves, and hope it has some kind of effect. If that seems weak, think how people across the US responded to Buddhist monks walking for peace across the country. 24 monks set out from their meditation center in Texas last October and walked over 2,000 miles to Washington, D.C. Crowds gathered along the way. Millions followed their progress on Facebook and Instagram, and thousands greeted them at the Lincoln Memorial when they arrived in Washington last week. Why did the monks stir such a powerful reaction? For one thing, they were walking through a divided country. Up north, in Minnesota, violence was spiralling, the outward sign of much deeper divisions. The monks were different. They exuded peace. That's powerful in itself, but they also had a message. The particular tradition these monks follow emphasises mindfulness, which these days is often regarded as an innocuous soothing exercise, especially helpful for getting to sleep. For serious practitioners like these monks with their steady gait and blooded feet, it means being present and giving things one's full attention. In that way, you experience your mind's tendency to busyness and agitation. You see the reactive patterns of your thoughts, and that lets you recognise the sources of suffering right there in the mind, and maybe break the circuit. The Buddha long ago taught that we're driven by forces we barely recognise. He named them as craving, aversion, and delusion. The world, samsara, he said, is simply those forces writ large, and the news, which we can find so overwhelming, reflects them. The monks' simple message was that it's possible to be different, and their choice to step out of their monastic retreat into the world was just as significant. By embodying mindfulness and peace so publicly, without being overtly political, they symbolised an alternative to the challenges facing American society. I think the response showed how deeply people yearn for that alternative. And that's another source of hope in these difficult times.
That was Thought for the Day with Vishwapani. The time now, 9 minutes to eight.
A big global AI summit is being held in India this week. It's the first to be held in the global south. At least 45 countries are expected to attend, and they'll debate the future of some of the fastest growing technology that we have. Among the distinguished speakers is Professor Yoshua Bengio, one of the world's leading artificial intelligence researchers and a pioneer of deep learning. He's described as one of the three godfathers of AI. He is also the chair of the International AI Safety Report. It's an annual analysis of the challenges we face. I've been speaking to him, and he is concerned that governments, indeed that we all, are not yet fully understanding the risks that AI poses.
Capabilities of AI have continued to advance. And although mitigation and risk management of AI has also progressed, not as quickly. And so it becomes urgent, in my opinion, that leaders of this world understand where we could be going and that needs their attention and intervention as soon as possible.
Before we talk a little more about how to regulate it, explain to me those risks that you were talking about there. What have you identified as the really key issues that we need to be watching?
We are building systems that are slowly, well, rapidly actually approaching human intelligence in a jagged way. So they could be stupid on some things and much better than most people on other things. And we don't know how to control their behavior so that, for example, terrorists will not be able to use them to launch cyber attacks or bioweapons attacks. Also, these systems seem to have goals of their own that go against our instructions. And they might resist being shut down, for example. And that is also very concerning. Finally, the changes in society that are likely to happen as these systems become more powerful and more agentic, in other words, able to achieve goals that we set or that they set for themselves, include a lot of unknown unknowns, but clearly some significant impact on society, on the labor market. More recently, we've seen unexpected effects on individuals, psychological problems, even tragic events with people becoming emotionally attached to AI systems, touching children in particular.
Looking at the safety report, it reads to me like the main mitigating factor at the moment is that the technology is not quite there yet, but at some point it will be. And what do we do then?
Well, we should do it now while we can, because it takes time for society to adapt. So we've seen some progress on these fronts in terms of regulation. The AI Act now has its code of practice, which has been signed by a majority of the leading providers of the most advanced AI models. We've seen new legislation in a few states in the US. But for now, these are not sufficient. And we're seeing the market forces leading to very strong competition between companies and also the geopolitical competition, apparently leading to cutting corners on matters of public safety and the effects on society and democracy also, as these tools are used for disinformation in a way that could grow significantly in the future if the trends continue.
It sounds very much to me, listening to you speak, that you don't feel that those risks have been fully appreciated yet by world leaders, by business leaders, by the sorts of people who should be putting regulation in place and making sure that this is a tool that benefits us and doesn't become a problem. It sounds like people have identified that there are issues, but they're not where they should be in terms of trying to sort them out.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's the reality. We see very clear facts that can be measured in the evolution of capabilities of AI on benchmarks. And those facts point to greater and greater capabilities, but also something new. So greater and greater agency. So in other words, these AIs are now being deployed more and more in a way that doesn't have a human in the loop without the human oversight, so that they can do more tasks that human in the past were doing, which of course is worth a lot of money, but creates all kinds of risks. What we have also been seeing is risks that previously, until, for example, the previous report, were theoretical and anticipated, but without evidence, now are seen empirically. So we are seeing these systems reason about how to preserve themselves. We're seeing these systems willing to be deceptive, even to blackmail an engineer so that they would not be shut down. And of course, we don't want to build tools that don't want to be shut down. This is dangerous as those tools become more and more autonomous and smarter and smarter.
Given all of that, why do you think we have been so slow to deal with this? Because the things you're describing, they are foreseeable. If we look at Hollywood movies, for example, that play out storylines based on these scenarios, it's not beyond the scope of human imagination. So why haven't we dealt with it?
Because of the forces of competition. Even well-willing people in the companies that are building the most advanced systems are under pressure to deliver the next version quickly so that their investors will continue to pump money into these companies so that there'll be more users and that they will not lose ground to their competitors. And that means they have to cut corners on what is cost for everyone, just like pollution. But here it's all kinds of risks of misuse, of loss of control.
Is there still time for governments to really get a grasp of this? Because as you say and as you've identified, the technology is moving so quickly. Have we missed our opportunity or can we still get this back?
Well, while there's life, there's hope. And we have to do something, even if we're not sure it's going to be sufficient. There's absolutely a chance to redress and to move things in the right direction. In fact, I think every one of us should ask ourselves, what can I do to move the needle, even a little bit, to reduce the chances of bad things happening to me, to my children, to my neighbors, to humanity in general, to our democratic principles? There's lots that we can do individually, and especially when we get together and we elect our representatives in government, we can make a big difference.
Professor Yoshua Bengio, thanks for joining us. Thank you.
My pleasure.
So much to think about there. What about the weather? Let's hear that. Ben Rich has got that for us.
Hi there, Nick. Thank you. Good morning to you. Compared with some of the weather we've had recently, I think today is going to be one of the brighter days. Quite a lot of sunshine in the forecast. But I'm going to start across the northern half of the UK today because that's where we have the risk of some ice through the next couple of hours or so. Parts of Scotland, Northern Ireland, Northern England, down into Eastern England as well. Some icy stretches on untreated roads and pavements. Still some wintry showers as well into the northeast of Scotland and maybe one or two running along the east coast of England. But these areas, Northern Ireland, Scotland, Northern England, Eastern England, seeing plenty of sunshine as we go through today. That sunshine may just turn a little hazy from the west later on. Now for Wales, for the Midlands and for the southeast of England, here lots of sunshine around this morning, but I think we will see more cloud rolling in from the west, turning the sunshine hazy, and then I think that cloud thickening up further as we go through at the end of the day. For the southwest of England, slightly different story here. A bit of sunshine this morning, but that cloud will thicken up fairly quickly and we'll see some outbreaks of quite heavy rain arriving across the southwest of England during the mid-afternoon. Temperatures north to south today around 4 to 9 degrees, so feeling fairly chilly. As we go through tonight, we will see some heavy rain across the southwest of England, some wet weather too for Wales, and also for Northern Ireland, some clear spells elsewhere.
Thank you, Ben. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson.
Good morning, it's 8 o'clock on Tuesday, the 17th of February. The headlines this morning, new figures show that the unemployment rate unexpectedly rose to its highest level for 5 years in the final 3 months of last year, and that wage growth has also slowed. After the news, we'll speak to the former Health Secretary, Alan Milburn, who's investigating why so many young people are now not in education, employment or training. The government has defended its U-turn on local elections after announcing that voting in 30 areas of England would not be delayed after all. And President Trump has said he'll be indirectly involved in talks between American officials and Iran about the country's nuclear programme.
Also in the next hour, not content with just having a smash hit history podcast, Dominic Sandbrook is turning his attention to the wonderful world of books, and GP records can now be linked to the UK Biobank, which holds the data of 500,000 Britons who signed up to give blood samples to the project. We'll find out why it's being described as a watershed moment. All that after the BBC News, read for us this morning by Charles Carroll.
The rate of unemployment in the UK rose unexpectedly to 5.2% in the 3 months to the end of December. This was greater than analysts had expected, and it's the highest level in nearly 5 years. Figures also released by the Office for National Statistics show the rate at which wages have been increasing slowed down. Economists said the data would fuel expectations that the Bank of England will cut interest rates sooner rather than later. Here's our business correspondent, Theo Leggett.
Slow economic growth in the second half of last year and a late November budget contributed to what the ONS described as weak hiring activity. The number of people on company payrolls fell by 130,000 across the year to December, while more people who were out of work were actively looking for a job, pushing the unemployment rate up to a near five-year high. Average pay grew by 4.2%, down from 4.7% in the previous survey, with public sector wages still growing much faster than those in the private sector. Economists said the latest figures would reinforce expectations that inflation will fall back, making it likely the Bank of England would choose to cut interest rates soon, possibly at its next rate-setting meeting in March.
A group representing election administrators has warned that they face an uphill struggle to organise polling in 30 English councils affected by yesterday's government U-turn. Labour had backed delays to the May vote in these areas because of plans to reorganise local authorities, but yesterday ministers reversed their stance in the face of a legal challenge brought by Reform UK. Here's our political correspondent, Joe Pike.
The government initially argued that their reorganisation of English local government meant it would be expensive and rather pointless to hold elections to councils that in a year or two might not exist. However, ministers' public endorsements of delays may also have damaged their legal case. Speaking to this programme, the Care Minister Stephen Kinnock conceded that the reversal in approach had been painful.
I'm definitely not pretending that the change in the legal position is ideal. You know, it's just not. And we hold our hands up and recognise that we had a piece of legal advice and then things have changed.
Postponing the elections could have been to Labour's political advantage, but Mr Kinnock denied that the government had been attempting to postpone elections that it thought it might lose. Out of 30 councils where votes will now go ahead, the party effectively controls 21. Opinion polls suggest some of them may be difficult to defend. The Association of Election Administrators said they were now playing catch-up, and there was little time to print ballots, organise staff and venues. The District Councils Network said voters would be bewildered.
President Trump has said that he will be indirectly involved in talks between Iran and the US, which are due to take place in the Swiss city of Geneva. He described the discussions about the Iranian nuclear program as very important and added that he didn't think Tehran wanted the consequences of not making a deal. There's been a large American military build-up in the region, prompting speculation the US could carry out a strike against Iran. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucet, is reporting from Tehran on condition that none of her material is used on the BBC's Persian service. These restrictions apply to all international organisations operating in Iran.
Both American and Iranian negotiators say they want a deal. What's not clear is just how wide the gaps are between them. Iranian officials say they're ready to compromise as long as the US is ready to lift sanctions, now crippling Iran's economy. They're also adamant that these talks can focus only on their nuclear program, not on other issues, including ballistic missiles, which some senior US officials, as well as Israel, insist must be on the table. Iran believes it's now winning this argument. But President Trump continues to send conflicting signals. He often says he prefers to do a deal, but he recently remarked that regime change would be the best thing to happen in Iran.
Officials in Ukraine say that Russia launched a barrage of almost 400 drones and missiles overnight at targets across the country. In the southern city of Odessa, there were reports of multiple explosions, injuring at least two people. A Ukrainian energy company said there had been serious damage to the region's power infrastructure. Russia says its air defence systems shot down more than 150 Ukrainian drones overnight. The wave of attacks comes as the two sides prepare for US-mediated talks in Geneva. Patients, their relatives and whistleblowers have described a culture of physical abuse and neglect at a mental health hospital in Northampton, where police are carrying out three separate investigations. The majority of the patients at St Andrew's Hospital, run by the mental health charity St Andrew's Healthcare, have been referred by the NHS. Matt Pressey reports.
A damning care quality commission report in December described how inspectors had seen CCTV recordings showing staff at St Andrews kicking and hitting patients. 15 staff members have been arrested in the past 18 months. 10 remain on bail, facing a range of allegations including willful neglect and assault. One person's been arrested on suspicion of rape. St Andrews says it had reported its staff to the police and that an urgent action plan is in place to make improvements.
The BBC has found that thousands of NHS staff are being referred to debt collectors because errors in the payroll system have led to them being overpaid. Trade unions say not enough is being done to resolve the issues before bailiffs become involved, creating extra stress for health workers. Charlie Haynes reports.
We put in Freedom of Information requests to NHS trusts across the UK. Of the 142 that gave us comparable data, we found that while the number of overpayments has stayed roughly the same for the last 5 years, around 50,000, debt collection referrals have increased by close to 50% to 2,683. One doctor told us the first time he was made aware he'd been paid too much was when he received a court summons. NHS England says it has established a payroll improvement programme in response to our investigation.
Up to 50,000 people are gathering in Delhi for an international meeting on the future of artificial intelligence, which will consider how to ensure that it's safe. Our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman, is travelling to Delhi.
There's huge excitement in India that it's hosting this fourth and largest annual global AI summit, the first having been held in the UK. Despite the pledges at previous events to maximise AI's benefits while minimising its risks, the tech continues to disrupt jobs, generate misinformation and raise concerns with the misuse of AI tools to create explicit deepfake images. Western countries are racing to lead the AI revolution, but there are concerns that low and middle income nations, such as India, which have built the foundations for the AI giants, aren't reaping the same rewards.
A BBC investigation has revealed how two special agents from the US Department for Homeland Security rescued a 12-year-old girl who had been sexually abused for 6 years after finding images of her on the dark web. Initially, the only information which the agents had was the girl's location, somewhere in America. Sam Parenti reports.
When Special Agents Greg Squire and Pete Manning discovered pictures of a 12-year-old girl, all they had to go on to try to find her was what they could see in the room she was in. The agents traced all the people who'd bought items like those in the room to see if any of them had been flagged as child abusers. Then they sent a photo of the exposed brick wall in the room to US brick experts. A salesman identified the brick and narrowed the girl's location down to one city. After cross-referencing that with who'd purchased items, the agents found her within days.
The girl's abuser was subsequently sentenced to more than 70 years in jail. Royal Mail has been given 2 weeks to respond to allegations that it's prioritising parcel deliveries over letters, causing delays across the postal network. In a letter to the company, the Commons Business and Trade Committee has asked for commitment to improve a situation it describes as chaos. Our business reporter Peter Ruddick has the details.
Hundreds of people, including Royal Mail workers, have told the BBC of their concerns about the postal system. Some allege that overstretched workers are prioritising parcels over letters, leading to backlogs. Letters are then being delivered in batches, so some important correspondence is arriving late. In a letter to the company, the MPs have raised significant concerns about reports of service failures that go beyond normal seasonal pressures. Royal Mail said it understood the frustration when post didn't arrive as expected, but it was working to resolve some short-term disruption.
And that was Peter Ruddick.
Charles, thank you very much indeed. It's now 8:10. The latest jobs figures are out this morning and they contain worrying news. The unemployment rate hit a five-year high in the last 3 months of 2025. It's been going up every year since 2022. But more worrying than that is what I think is fair to describe as a jobs crisis facing the young. Unemployment amongst 16 to 24-year-olds was up 37,000 just in those 3 months. Over the year as a whole, almost 100,000. Last week, another set of figures published by the OECD showed that youth unemployment in this country is now higher than in the EU. The first time that's been true for more than a quarter of a century. In a moment, we'll hear from Alan Milburn. The man, you may remember, was Health Secretary under Tony Blair. He's now leading a government review into what he himself has called the national outrage of a lost generation of almost a million young people. who are defined as NEETs, not in education, employment or training. First, though, our business editor, Simon Jack, has been trawling through those numbers. And what do they tell us, Simon?
They tell us that the jobs market is still weak. Employers are still reluctant to take people on for a number of reasons we saw last year. There was a big increase in employers' national insurance. We saw, of course, the increases in the national living wage, particularly sharp for young people. And there's uncertainty around the employment rights bill. We also had a late budget. All that kind of creates uncertainty. So employers kind of sit on their hands. Now, the good news is that the hiring freeze seems to be thawing just a little bit. The number of vacancies out there has kind of leveled off after some very sharp drops, the number of people looking for employees. But overall, you could say this is still a pretty weak employment market.
And when you look at the type of jobs, what is that telling you?
Well, we've seen big falls in, you know, the biggest falls in employment we've seen in retail and hospitality. There you have quite a lot of young people employed there, people either at or close to the national living wage. I think the broader picture is that a lot of these uncertainties came at precisely the moment in the wider economy when employers are thinking, how many people do I actually need? Can I, you know, get automation? Can I deploy AI? You know, people are getting a bit more expensive and a bit riskier. Are there other ways to invest in the business in capital rather than labour?
Simon Jay, thank you very much indeed. Joining us here, as I mentioned, is Alan Milburn, who's now chair of what's called the Young People and Work Review, a review reporting to ministers, in particular Pat McFadden, the Work and Pensions Minister, and it's due to report in the summer. Morning to you, Mr. Milburn.
Morning.
We can do all the numbers. Put it into words. What are young people facing at the moment?
Well, we face the risk. It's existential, I think, of a lost generation, a million young people, as you say. That's one in eight of all young people. If they formed a city, it would be the third biggest in the country. So we're seeing something dramatic changing in the labour market. Simon hinted at some of it a moment or two ago. NEET rates, young people not in education, employment and training, have been rising for the last 4 years. Youth employment rates have been falling. So this is not a short-term phenomenon. It's a long-term one. And I think it's something structural. So the thing to hold on to here is that youth unemployment is rising, but something even more profound is happening beneath the surface. 60% or more of those 1 million young people are economically inactive. That means they're not even looking for work. They're detached from the labour market. So the most horrifying statistic of many that I've come across is that 45% of 24-year-olds who are not in education, employment and training have never had a job.
And therefore,
if you haven't had a job, that's by 24, that entails a long-term scarring effect. And you're probably then stuck on a lifetime on benefits.
To be clear, because structural is a word that economists use, isn't it? And in simple terms, it means it's not because things are a bit tricky in the economy at the moment. It's a potentially permanent shift.
Correct. And I think what you've got is a perfect storm. So normally what happens is there's an economic downturn or growth is a bit anemic, which it is at the moment. Young people are the first to be hit, always, but then it bounces back. That isn't happening, and it's not going to happen, in my view, unless there are some profound changes in both what the government does, but what employers do. So we've got what I would describe as a downward escalator, where too many young people have poor health, poor education, then they end up in the benefit system as children, they then graduate into the benefit system as adults, and they get stuck there. That's a downward escalator. What we've got to do is put them on an upward escalator with decent jobs, better opportunities, good training, apprenticeships and so on. The government's doing some of that, but honestly, it needs to go much further and much faster.
That is an agenda of challenges for ministers, which I imagine are going to be quite uncomfortable. Now, you're not here to tell us what you've concluded because the group doesn't report until the summer. But at least can we go through your inbox?
Sure.
Let's deal with that downward escalator. You mentioned mental health.
Mm.
Are you saying, I think you are, that young people who are statemented, as it's called, who are designated as having special needs in schools, can find themselves on benefits pretty much for life and unable to get work once they leave school?
So they can. Something is going on. And obviously there's a separate piece of work which Wes Streeting, the health secretary, is commissioned in the Department of Health and Social Care to understand what really is going on clinically here. But what is obvious is that it's a more anxious generation. That's not peculiar to the UK. That's true across the world. There's rising neurodiversity conditions, autism, ADHD. That is seems to be happening everywhere. What seems to be peculiar to the United Kingdom is that these conditions are translating into economic inactivity at a scale that is markedly different from other countries. So our NEET rates, for example, are treble those of Holland, twice those of Japan or Ireland. And we're looking at those countries to understand what they're doing that is better. So there's evidence that we can bring back. This is not inevitable, what's going on. It can be addressed. What we can't have is a situation where a young person is diagnosed with a condition, then automatically, which is what the system almost seems to do at the moment, say, you're not fit to work. The best that we can aspire to you for this generation is a lifetime on benefits. That's a lifetime on the scrap heap.
Now, you are an experienced politician and you know what your old colleagues are going to say to you. They're going to say the last thing we need is a report recommending a squeeze on benefits at the time when your party, the Labour Party, is unpopular, it's facing an internal crisis of identity and direction and even about the future of the Prime Minister. What do you say to colleagues who say, not now, don't touch it?
This is not, look, what's happening in the benefit system, the rising number of young people in the last 5 years, the number of people claiming health and disability benefits has doubled in 5 years. But that's a symptom of a wider failure. Becoming NEET doesn't begin at 16. So, for example, if a child isn't school ready at the age of 4 or 5, they're 3 or 4 times more likely to be NEET at the age of 16 or 17. So this is a whole systems failure. It's a failure in early years, in schools, in skills, in mental health, and in welfare. And we're looking at it as a whole system because that's what people, young people do. They have a journey through life and they have a journey through this state system. And what is required, in my view, is fundamental reform across all of this. But this is not just a supply-side problem.
But what your colleagues may say to you, or your ex-colleagues in the House of Commons, is, I know what reform means when it comes from Alan Bilburn. He's an old Blairite. What it means is cutting the bills. It means austerity. It means conditions on people who've got tough lives already. We don't want it.
What it means is we've got to create more opportunities for young people. So the youth guarantee, which the government has introduced, in my view, is a good down payment. But we need to make sure that every young person, regardless of their background, and remember, the incidence of becoming NEET is so strongly correlated with social injustice and disadvantage. This should be a concern for every Labour Member of Parliament. You know, you're 3 times more likely, or 30% more likely, rather, to be a NEET if you grew up in Middlesbrough and in Knowsley than anywhere else in the country. So what we've got to do is...
Are you saying this is a moral mission?
So this is, in my view, the issue is existential. And therefore, we always think of it as a fiscal problem. It isn't. It's an economic problem, it's a social problem, and it's a moral problem. This should be the cause, not just for the Labour Party, but for politicians of all types and hues, and for the country as a whole. And it's very interesting, since we've begun this, I've been inundated by employers wanting to take action, Premier League football clubs wanting to take action, mayors, local authorities. This touches a nerve. And I think, Nick, it touches a nerve, if I may, for one very simple reason. The NEET story is just the nose to the story. What people are worried about is the opportunities available for this generation. This is the first generation, probably, that is not going to do better than their parents.
And I can hear employers shouting at the radio saying, I'm not going to take anybody involved with the Labour Party telling me about employing people when the bill for employing a young person has been increased as a matter of choice of this government. The minimum wage has gone up for the young, new working rights as soon as you get into work for the young. This is making it harder. Is that something you're willing to look at and explore?
So we've got to look at all of these issues. Obviously, when an employer takes on a young person, it's always a risk for a very simple reason. They're unproven. So what we've got to do is make sure that we're minimising the risks and maximising the incentives. That's what we've got to do. And we're going to need to look at this in the round. But anybody who thinks that the problem of youth unemployment and this problem about NEETs has just arisen in the last couple of years, look at the data. This has been going on for very many years.
We are talking on the day of a dramatic government U-turn. It's not in this field, it's about local elections, but it all began, really, didn't it, with U-turns over benefit cuts. What do you say to people in your party? I know you don't want to be a politician these days. You want to look at the evidence. But what do you say to people in our party? You say, we tried doing those sort of what they see as Tory-like measures. We don't want any more of it.
What I think... We, the country, not just the government or even the Labour Party needs to do, is look at what is happening to this generation. We risk a generation on the scrap heap. The system isn't working, either on the supply side or the demand side. And that does entail radical change. I mean, if I can just remind my colleagues in the Labour Party, the reason that Labour won was on a one-word slogan. It was called change. It's a really good idea to deliver it. This is about change. This review is about changing a system that isn't working, that is propelling young people into a lifetime on benefits. The clue is in the title. It's the Labour Party. It's supposed to be about work. We need a generation of young people not feeling a sense of hopelessness, but a sense of hope and optimism about the future. And that requires change.
Alan Milburn, Chair of the Young People and Work Review. Thank you for joining us. I hope you come back when you've got the findings of that review.
Thank you.
It is 21 minutes past eight now. Can the nation get back its reading habit? It's a question at the heart of this year's official National Year of Reading. We've been exploring it on this programme, both with our regular book clubs. We had another half-term one yesterday. If you missed it, you can find it this time yesterday on BBC Sounds. And also our series that we've been doing with some of the most loved authors in the country, telling us about the books which sparked their love of reading. And now Dominic Sandbrook from the Rest is History podcast is joining the fray with a new podcast, this time about books. It's called, very simply, The Book Club. It will cover titles from The Great Gatsby and 1984 to Hamlet and Normal People in its first run. And he joins us now. Morning, Dominic.
Morning. Morning, everybody.
Do you know, I find the figures on this, because we said, you know, one of the key things about the National Year of Reading is to get us reading again, and the figures bear it out. Last year, sales of non-fiction books were down 6% compared with 2024. It's the lowest total since 2017. In fact, one of the things that they say is putting us off books is podcasts, which is a little concerning for you.
I think people can do both, though, can't they? I mean, that's the point of our new show, is that people can listen to the podcast and they can also read along. And what we really want to try to do is get people... I mean, you mentioned nonfiction. I think, for me, the really sad thing is that people are reading less fiction than they used to be, particularly younger people. And I think the beauty of fiction in particular, and I say this as somebody who spends a lot of his time in nonfiction and history, I think the beauty of a novel is that it opens a window into a different world and it takes you out of your own subjectivity and your own experience. And, you know, it could be that some of the books you've mentioned, you know, Hamlet or 1984 or The Great Gatsby or whatever, or it could be something, you know, much more, what might seem much more throwaway. So the romanticy books that are so popular now with younger readers, young women especially. And the joy of them, I think, is that they give you a sense of, just for a second, just for that precious moment, of what it's like to be somebody else, to walk in somebody else's shoes. Of course, you're never really doing it. But I think what fiction in particular gives you is a kind of empathy, because it takes you, of course, outside the cocoon of your own experience and gives you that sort of precious, intangible, fragile sense of being somebody else. And I think that's what, especially these days, when we use social media so much basically as a mirror to reflect our own prejudices and proclivities, I think actually getting out of that and that moment of escape is so precious.
Yeah, and we almost deny it to ourselves because the world is busy and we think, I haven't got time for that. I need to know what's going on. I need to know facts. I need to know truth. Whereas right. actually, as you say, you know, we're kind of, that would give us something, the perspective that we're not getting. That would really help if we just took some time to explore those other worlds.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I mean, I don't think, I don't sort of massively go in for therapy speak, but the moment, you know, that time where you're sort of, you know, you throw yourself into the book, you immerse yourself in the author's prose and the experience of the characters, that moment of sort of slowing down and reflecting, I think is really, really important in a world where you're just being bombarded with images, with sounds and whatnot, with sensations. Just the stillness almost of reading, I think, is a very precious thing.
Yeah. I'm getting into this now. Here's another thought. It's a way, isn't it, to disagree quite amicably, because our opinions of a book, it's not rooted in fact. You can have different perceptions of it and everybody can be right. And unlike things in the wider world where you have facts and truth and somebody is wrong and it really polarizes, actually you can, you know, you can have conversations and you can think different things and actually that's okay.
Yeah, I think that's completely right, actually. I mean, you mentioned right at the beginning that I do a podcast called The Rest is History, which is obviously about you know, factual history. And the difference between doing that and the new show, The Book Club, is that actually in The Book Club, my co-presenter Tabitha and I will often have diametrically opposed views of a book. So we recently recorded an episode about East of Eden, which is coming out in a few weeks. And Tabby loves East of Eden. I don't really like it. But obviously neither of us is, in inverted commas, right. And it's the interplay of ideas about books that makes it so invigorating and makes it so fun to talk about. The fact is, you know, different people will have diametrically different opinions about, let's say, Wuthering Heights, which is our first episode. I mean, that's a book that's always polarized opinions, right from when Emily Bronte published it in the Victorian period. But the joy of talking about books is that you can share your views without it feeling like a high stakes, you know, game, which it often is when you're talking about politics, for example, that actually you can both be right in your own minds. And it's about, so much of it is about your personal, you know, internal, intimate relationship with the book and with the characters and so on. And that's why, you know, you mentioned some of the other books we're doing, like Hamnet, for example. That's why, you know, when people read Maggie O'Farrell's book, they had such a visceral personal reaction to the themes of grief and loss and parenthood and all of those things, because they are, you know, they're part of being human, aren't they?
Yeah. And you're dealing with some of the old classics, as you said, things like Wuthering Heights, which has been debated and dissected and picked apart for generations now, but also some of the newer ones as well. You're going to do Normal People, you know, ones that haven't made it into the literature courses just yet.
Right. Exactly. So Normal People, I mean, Normal People is a great example of the sort of book we want to do, because frankly, as a middle-aged man, it's not the kind of book I would immediately turn to. I probably would never have read it if we hadn't done this show. But I really enjoyed doing it because it sort of forced me to do something that I wouldn't naturally have done. And I think obviously Normal People is a young person's book. It's about young people. It was written by Sally Rooney when she was, what, in her early to mid-20s, I think. And I think that's the sort of joy of it. I think the other thing about, you know, funny enough about podcasts, a lot of podcasts are listened to by men. So The Rest Is History is a good example. I don't think I'm betraying any trade secrets when I say that the majority of our audience are men. One of the things I've noticed with doing this show is that the people who've responded, you know, to the stuff we put out on social media and stuff are predominantly women. And I think that's a really fun thing for me personally as a presenter, to be reaching a different kind of audience. And I think, you know, we're not snobby about books. So actually one of the book that I'm reading right now that my co-presenter Tabby has forced me to read for the show is a book called A Court of Thorns and Roses by Sarah J. Maas. Okay. And it's one of the best-selling books. I mean, a lot of your listeners, I'm guessing, will not have heard of it, but it is by far one of the best-selling books of the last 10 years. It's a romanticy book. And a lot of people would say, oh gosh, that's beneath you, you shouldn't be reading that. But not at all. I mean, the beauty of books is that they're democratic, and that you should not, you know, I really don't think you should sneer at books or whatever. You know, if your kids are reading and they want to read comic books or whatever, that's great. Any form of reading, I think, is really important.
Yeah, it's always a good thing. Dominic Sandbrook, thank you for being with us. And Dominic and Tabitha's new podcast, it's called The Book Club, as we were saying, and it's out today.
And it's 28 minutes past eight now. Time for Carthy to give us some more sports news.
Morning. Thank you very much. There was an excellent effort from Macclesfield, but the sixth-tier side were denied a place in the fifth round of the FA Cup by an own goal in the 70th minute against the Premier League's Brentford. 1-0 the final score. Brentford go on to meet West Ham in the fifth round. The full FA Cup draw is on the BBC Sport website. To the Winter Olympics, and freestyle skier Kirsty Muir finished in fourth place for the second time. Muir missed out on slopestyle bronze last week, and she was just outside the podium places in last night's big air final. Great Britain's men's curling team lost 8-6 to Norway, leaving their semi-final hopes in doubt. They face Canada and the United States to be sure of making the last four, and Dave Ryding finished in 17th in his fifth and final Winter Olympics. And a man who knows all about the pressure of competing at the Winter Olympics, the former British Winter Olympian Eddie Edwards. You may know him as Eddie the Eagle, is joining us. Eddie, morning.
Good morning.
There have been three gold medals for Great Britain and Northern Ireland so far. It's the first time that Team GB has won more than a single gold at a Winter Olympics. How encouraged are you by the potential impact this could have on the next generation, which is something that I know you're very keen on?
Oh, absolutely. It's been fantastic, really, because you know, we're not really a winter nation, to be fair. And it's nice to come back with a single medal, but to come back with three is just amazing so far. So, you know, fantastic effort from all our athletes. It's been brilliant.
Well, you mentioned the fact that we're not really a winter sports nation. Funding comes from governing bodies, the National Lottery, sponsorship, various places. We discussed this yesterday with the CEO of GB Snow Sport, the challenge of the lack of snowy mountains and freestyle courses in the UK. Once you're competing, though, you do end up on the World Cup circuit, don't you? How difficult is it to get started, and how much have things changed from your day?
Oh, it's they get probably more funding now than we did back in the day. I was sleeping in the back of my car and sleeping in cow sheds and scraping food out of bins. And I'm sure the athletes of today are doing a lot better than that. But yeah, funding is always an issue because, you know, you've got to travel so far, even to do the World Cup circuit around Europe and around the world, and getting there and staying there. It costs an awful lot of money. So probably more so than your average athlete who can sort of run around the park, 5 minutes from their house type thing.
Yeah, you were doing this, you were competing at the Winter Olympics. Well, it was 1988, wasn't it? Are you watching the current athletes with a critical eye or with a sympathetic eye? For those of us that haven't tried any of these sports, they are dangerous and difficult, aren't they?
They are very difficult, very dangerous sports, and a little bit of a critical eye, but also a sympathetic eye. I think, they're great to be seen and doing their best. And I think it's great that that we are out there and showing the world. I think Brits do like to see our athletes out there, and it shouldn't matter whether they're ranked number 8th or 10,000th in the world. We should be out there looking at them and cheering them on. And I can't believe it's been 38 years since Calgary. And when Readly, the newspaper and magazine app, got in touch, when they said that you're still in one of the top stories, from the Winter Olympics, going back 38 years, and I didn't win anything. So it's very very nice that people still remember me very very fondly.
Well, it's success and stories that people remember from the Olympics. You competed in this, for those that don't know, from 1988, in the ski jump for Great Britain. You were the first British athlete to compete in that event. It was made into a film a few years ago. It's a lifelong love for the sport, isn't it? Are you still skiing or even jumping at 62?
Oh, absolutely. I'm still skiing. I try and get away skiing most seasons, whether it's 1 week or sometimes up to 5 or 6 weeks in a season. And I am still ski jumping occasionally. I jumped about 4 years ago, just after COVID. I was in Courchevel in France, which is literally my closest ski jump. And in September this year, I'm going to an old ski jump that I used to jump on 40 years ago. And they've invited me back to do a bit of ski jumping. So in September, I'll get my jumping skis out and try and fly through the air as best I can.
Well, your enthusiasm is infectious. Eddie Edwards, thank you very much for joining us this morning. The BBC's coverage of the Winter Olympics continues on the iPlayer and BBC One from 9 a.m. And just to finish with a bit of Cricket World Cup news from the T20 World Cup. England had another scare in the group stage. They eventually beat Italy yesterday by 24 runs. Australia's hopes of reaching the Super 8 stage of the competition now depend on other results after they were defeated by Sri Lanka. Ireland are playing Zimbabwe at 9:30 this morning. They could still reach the last eight. And Scotland face Nepal at 1:30, but they cannot qualify. There's commentary of all the games on BBC Sounds and Five Sports Extra.
Thank you, Cathy. Let's look ahead to this afternoon on Radio 4.
What happens when someone's personality changes completely?
That's not Dad. There's something else that's gone on there.
I'm Noel Titheridge, and in a new series for Radio 4, I explore how medications prescribed to treat movement disorders like Parkinson's and restless leg syndrome have been linked to profound impulsive changes in behaviour. If these side effects can destroy relationships and even lead to criminality, why weren't some patients and families warned?
How much had I known him beforehand, and how much had I not known?
Impulsive continues this afternoon at 1:45 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Quick look at the weather now. This morning will be dry with light winds and plenty of winter sunshine. Cloud in the afternoon, but should stay dry.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Anna Foster. It is 26 minutes to 9. Charles Carroll has a summary of the news.
The latest figures for the rate of unemployment issued this morning show that it rose slightly to 5.2% in the 3 months to December, a five-year high. The former Labour Health Secretary, Alan Milburn, who's now chairing a report into young people and work, told us that 45% of 24-year-olds had never had a job. He said this amounted to a whole system failure, and he said that the government needed to do more to ensure young people didn't feel a sense of hopelessness. A group representing election administrators has warned that they face an uphill struggle to organise polling in 30 English councils affected by yesterday's government U-turn. Labour had backed delays to the May vote in these areas because of plans to reorganise local authorities. But yesterday, ministers reversed their stance in the face of a legal challenge brought by Reform UK. The Health Minister, Stephen Kinnock, told us the changing legal advice wasn't ideal. And President Trump has said that he will be indirectly involved in talks between Iran and the US, which are due to take place in Geneva. He said that he didn't think Tehran wanted the consequences of not making a deal on its nuclear program.
Thank you, Charles. Royal Mail has been given 2 weeks to respond to allegations that were first reported by the BBC that it's prioritising parcel deliveries over letters, resulting in delays for those letters across the postal network. Now, one postal worker, whose words you'll hear spoken by an actor, explained to the BBC why some of those delays were happening behind the scenes.
Parcels are always prioritised, provided they're tracked. And if they're not tracked and they're small parcels, they often get left behind. If they're small parcels and they're first class, then that is supposed to take priority over second class. But the truth of it is, if there's a large parcel at second class, we take it because we don't want it in the delivery office getting in the way the next day.
Well, Ian Byrne is Labour MP, Chair of the Business and Trade Committee. Good morning.
Anna, good morning.
You're not happy about this. You've asked for more information.
We have. I mean, I think lots of MPs are telling us that the Royal Mail deliveries are in a state of chaos in their constituencies. Royal Mail lists about 100 postcodes where they say there is service disruption. What we're hearing from MPs is that the disruption is much wider than that. Ofcom obviously fined Royal Mail last October, £21 million for missing their targets. It would appear to us that Royal Mail has not got the message. And so we want to see what is the plan to get Royal Mail deliveries back on track. And I think what's happened this morning in the light of your reporting is we're now getting lots of whistleblowers coming forward and explaining what is actually going on in the sorting offices.
What degree of disruption is Royal Mail allowed to have, given that even if that's going on, people are still paying the same amount for a stamp, they're still paying the same amount for deliveries? What sort of flexibility do they have, and at what point do they start to go beyond what they're allowed?
Well, they haven't got a lot of flexibility. The universal service obligation is quite tough. So they've got to deliver about 93% of first-class mail on time, 98.5% of second-class mail on time. Last October, they were only delivering about three-quarters of first-class letters when they were supposed to. And so Ofcom said, look, you need to give us a plan pronto for ensuring that 99% of mail is delivered no later than 2 days off track. It's pretty clear to us that's not happening. I've had people emailing me this morning from all over the country saying that they've gone for weeks without deliveries over the course of December. And we're also getting insights from frontline postal workers who are saying that managers have been incentivized to cut headcount. There are overtime bans. There are deteriorating working conditions. The rounds were not redesigned for those headcount reductions. And so you're getting backlogs that are building up in sorting offices. They're not being completed because the rounds are too big each day. That means that delivery rounds are coming back into the depots, which are already too full. And just to, you know, add insult to injury, Royal Mail is then, it would appear to be, prioritising parcels over letters. So put all of that together and you've got a service that looks like it's collapsing.
Mm. So you're welcoming, as you said, people who know what's going on to get in touch, and also you're expecting to hear from Royal Mail themselves. There was something else I wanted to ask you about as well while you're here, and that is about the former Prince Andrew, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, and the calls for an investigation into some of his work as a trade envoy, emails that he passed on, reports of visits to Singapore and Hong Kong and Vietnam, potentially commercially sensitive information about gold and uranium investments in Afghanistan, a confidential document that he passed on. Now, he has denied any wrongdoing. Thames Valley Police have said they're looking into it, but it would seem a prime thing for your committee to get involved in as well.
Yeah, the committee's not had a chance to reflect on these allegations because recess means Parliament isn't sitting this week. But my task this week is to make sure that the committee's got options in front of them when they meet on Tuesday for how we might or might not take this investigation forward. Obviously, we can't and don't want to compromise a police investigation. We've got quite strict rules about sub judice and getting involved in things that may come before the courts. But this is obviously a matter of huge concern, and I'm going to make sure that my committee's got the full options available for how we take our investigations forward when they convene next Tuesday morning.
Would you potentially ask to speak to him to try and clear some of those details up?
Don't want to prejudge where the committee is going to go on this at this stage.
Would it be one of your options, though? You said you haven't sort of considered what your final one will be just yet, but that would be one of them.
At this stage, all I can say is nothing is off the table.
Okay. And as we said, you know, I think the concern for a lot of people is that this will fall through the cracks because of who it is and because of what surrounds him. And as I said, I imagine that your committee, and I know you're not keen to be drawn on too much of the detail, but I think people are hoping to hear from you that this is something that you're taking seriously and something that you will be looking into.
I mean, this is something we're going to take acutely seriously, and I can guarantee you that MPs are not in the market for letting anything slip through the cracks. But, you know, this is a committee decision. It's a cross-party commission. It's a cross-party committee elected across the House of Commons. And so I just can't prejudge what conclusions the committee will come to. My job as the chair is to make sure that the options are on the table in front of them when we consider it next week, when Parliament resumes.
Liam Byrne, Chair of the Business and Trade Committee. Thank you.
It's coming up to 19 minutes to nine now.
Now, the public inquiry into undercover police officers who lied about their identities to partners, even in court, while they tried to infiltrate groups of environmental activists, is still turning up new information all the time, even years after it began. And in the last few days, it's been hearing the story of one officer, Jim Boyling, who was praised by his seniors for lying about who he really was during a legal case. And when that came to light, two activists' criminal convictions were overturned. Well, Rob Evans joins us. He wrote Undercover, the true story of Britain's secret police. Good morning.
Good morning.
I said they're years after it began. This is a very long-running public inquiry, but you are continuing to follow it and this sort of detail which continues to come out of it.
Yes, I mean, the inquiry was commissioned actually in 2014. And it continues. I mean, what it's looking at are undercover operations by undercover officers to infiltrate tens of thousands of political activists over a period of more than four decades. The undercover officers essentially were police officers. They assumed a new identity, or a fake identity of being a political activist, and they went undercover for typically about 4 or 5 years. And while they were pretending to be a political activist, they were actually passing back all the information about what those activists were doing back to their police superiors.
And at the time, this was being done. This is what they were told to do. This is what their superiors were instructing them to do. They were praising them, as we've heard in the last few days, for doing that successfully. You talk about relationships. There were incidents in court where they were still using these pseudo identities, which led to real problems down the line.
Yes, I mean, what the inquiry is set up essentially because the police committed a series of abuses that they indulged in wrongdoing, misconduct. And that's what the inquiry is set up to look at. And one thing that they're looking at, one of the most important strands, is about how, while the undercover officers were in their fake identity, they formed relationships with women, which were long-term relationships. These are relationships lasting, four, five, 6 years. And throughout those relationships, they conceal from the women their real identity. And these women were essentially being deceived by these undercover officers. Some of the women actually had children.
Yeah. I mean, the Metropolitan Police have acknowledged the serious wrongdoing and totally unacceptable behaviour, as they describe it, by some specialist demonstration squad SDS undercover officers. They say that they have apologised again unreservedly. They also say that undercover policing has undergone significant reform over the decades since this happened. From your kind of intimate knowledge of this story and how much work you've done on it, you see changes, do you, in the way things like this happen now?
It's difficult to know. I mean, this is a very covert area. What the police are doing now, we just don't know. We know that the state wants to, it monitors political activists. How it does that, we just don't know. We've got almost no visibility about how they're doing that.
Mm. Yeah, that's a really interesting point, I suppose, because it remains undercover, doesn't it? Thank you, Rob. Rob Evans, who wrote Undercover, the True Story of Britain's Secret Police. And Alison is with us as well, part of the organisation Police Spies Out of Lives. Alison, good morning.
Good morning.
What was your experience? You were caught up in this.
Yes, I was involved in a relationship for 5 years with an undercover officer who I knew as Mark Cassidy, whose real name was Mark Jenner.
who I later discovered was married with children throughout our whole relationship. And I think what the stories of the women evidence is the institutionalized misogyny in the police, which is playing out across society at the moment. And it's that that we want to address. So yes, as I was listening to your conversation with Rob, and the College of Policing guidelines have changed on this. They changed in 2024, but the law hasn't changed. And that's what we're campaigning for, a change in the law that makes this kind of behaviour illegal.
Yeah, because I imagine for you, having been in that situation, the difficulty, first of all, is that somebody did it to you. But then beyond that, it's that they did it, that it was encouraged, that it was sanctioned, that it feels like the whole system was working against you.
That's right. These are not just officers who, these are not just individuals who, you know, lied in a pub about being an airline pilot. It was systemic. When the eight of us first brought the case in 2011, and subsequently as the inquiry has continued, more women have discovered that they were also deceived into sexual relationships. And what we're seeing is patterns of behaviour. It was systemic. Managers knew. You know, Mark Jenner, when he gave his evidence before December, took about 6 minutes to write down the list of all the names of his colleagues and officers who knew about our relationship. There's a back office. They've got professional documentation. Mark had they all have machine read passports. They travelled abroad. They had driving licences issued by the DVLA. They had national insurance cards. There's a back room of, you know, there's a back room supporting the deceit. And it's that we want to exposed, and we want it never to happen again to other women. So we're told, yes, things have changed, but the laws governing undercover operatives also apply to MI5 and MI6, which this inquiry is not looking at. So unless there's a proper deterrent for these men to, you know, fear that it's a criminal offence if they deceive a woman into having sex without giving informed consent, unless we get that change in the law, we don't have very much confidence that it's not continuing to happen.
And you're pushing for that change. And at the same time, you yourself are also still attending these public inquiry hearings to support the women who are still at them.
Yeah, absolutely. We support each other. As many of us can get there as we can, that's what our organisation is about. Our organisation is there to campaign for change around sex by deception and around the legislation governing undercover operations. And we want some of these officers who were awarded honours. Bob Lambert, who had 3 relationships with women undercover, has an MBE. Maybe others do as well, because many of them still have anonymity. And we feel that if it's good enough for Andrew Mountbatten to have his title removed, it's good enough for Bob Lambert to have his honour removed. So we're absolutely there at the inquiry. And next week, Donna McLean and Lindsay, a woman known as Lindsay, will be giving evidence about the relationship they were deceived into by Carlos Seracchi, who will be giving evidence the following week.
Thank you, Alison there, as we're calling her, part of the organisation Police Spies Out of Lives.
It's now 12 minutes to 9. 23 years ago, 500,000 people signed up to a project they thought could change the future of medicine. It's called UK Biobank, the world's biggest human imaging project. But it is only after a long, long battle lasting many years that the initial promise can be fulfilled. In what's been called a watershed moment, GP medical records can now be linked in full to UK Biobank to enable researchers to understand the causes and progressions of diseases and ageing. We're joined by the chief scientist at Biobank UK, Professor Naomi Allen. Morning to you.
Morning.
Just before we get to the last piece in the jigsaw of these records, the GP records, just spell out the ambition of Biobank. What is it aiming to do?
So UK Biobank is one of the world's most powerful health research resources. So it's a population-based study of 500,000 volunteers who generously shared their data with us over 15, 20 years ago. And it's helping scientists around the world to uncover the causes, treatments, and how to prevent diseases that affect people in middle and later life.
Now, the problem you have faced is that you weren't allowed to get access to GP records. Why, if you had lots of other medical data, was that such a problem?
So you're right, there's been up until now no straightforward way to obtain GP data for all of our 500,000 participants, despite the fact that when they joined the study 15 to 20 years ago, they gave their consent for us to follow up their health over time through linkage to their health records, which obviously includes primary care data. And this is because each GP practice, of which there are thousands around the country, had to give specific approval to release the data to UK Biobank. Now, I think it really is a watershed moment because the way through has been implemented by the government so that coded GP data on diagnoses, prescriptions, lab results, etc., can be forwarded to UK Biobank. So this removes the burden of responsibility from busy GPs so that we can now honour participant wishes and link primary care data into UK Biobank along all the vast amount of genetic, lifestyle, biomarker data that we already hold to really accelerate health-related research into common conditions that are largely diagnosed and managed in primary care, like arthritis, back pain, depression, asthma, diabetes, dementia, and many others.
So in those conditions, what this means, does it, is that there's a kind of pattern in patient either behaviour or symptoms that researchers can now analyse in order to say, over a scale, we can see that people tend to report 2, 3 years, 4 years before with this as a signal of something that's coming. That's what you're aiming to do, is it?
Absolutely. So, for example, the addition of GP data will double the number of recorded cases in UK Biobank of depression and dementia in the cohort. And it also captures less severe disease before people go to hospital. So this enables researchers to study the full spectrum of disease severity, from early symptoms to advanced stages, and to enable research that really understands what are the likely genetic and lifestyle determinants of those diseases and how it changes over time.
Fascinating. So, we're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid. Professor Naomi Allen, Chief Scientist at Biobank UK, thanks for joining us.
It is 8 minutes to 9. I have a little breaking cultural news for you. Will it be a rare year of British triumph at the Eurovision Song Contest this year, or another classic Ni Le Point flop? Possibly the latter. But the BBC's just announced that YouTuber and experimental singer-songwriter Sam Battle, who's known online as Look Mum No Computer, will be the one who represents the UK in Vienna in May. We don't know what the actual entry for the contest will sound like yet, but here is a taste of his song Commotion. Asbestos, I'm never gonna leave. As much as I would love to reanimate these dead old. It's just a little flavour of the artist Look Mum No Computer, who will be representing the UK at Eurovision this year.
We just want to know where that name's come from, don't we, Look Mum No Computer? It's intriguing.
So many questions.
Yeah, so many questions. Incidentally, stay with us here on Radio 4 after 9 o'clock, because there's going to be a fascinating story from Jenny Kleeman telling the story of hackers who stole therapy notes from a Finnish psychotherapy centre and tried to ransom them. It's the biggest cybercrime, well, in Finland. But it's a cracking story. Let's end with what I suspect will also be a cracking story from award-winning author, the woman who wrote We Need to Talk About Kevin, Lionel Shriver, who joins us in the studio. Now, it's not normal for an author to describe their own new novel as very risky, but Lionel's done just that. She's author of a new book called A Better Life, and even pointed to a review in one of her interviews which described a book as hackneyed paranoid xenophobia. Not her opinion, I assume, but just confirming that there are some people who will like the book and others who might like it rather less. Lionel Shriver, author of A Better Place, joins us in the studio. Morning to you.
Good morning.
Let's begin with what this book is about. Inspired by reality, a real proposal for New Yorkers to be paid to put up asylum seekers in their homes.
Yes, the mayor of New York proposed this program, but never brought it to fruition. But I did. And so it's about a family in Brooklyn that, out of the goodness of their hearts and also to make a little bit of money on the side, invites a single Honduran immigrant into their home. She seems lovely, but at the same time, she's not the last Honduran immigrant who ends up in their home.
It seems lovely, but turns out to be something rather different. Turns out to be trouble.
Well, one of the things that the book asks is, who is this person? Is she as cheerful and helpful and innocent as she seems, and perhaps a victim of the kind of thugs that end up invading the house, or is she colluding with them?
That's why the book generates controversy, isn't it? Which is, many books about asylum seekers are very sympathetic to them. This book is rather sympathetic, it seems, from what I'm told, and forgive me, I haven't had a chance to read it yet, is sympathetic not to them, and indeed is highly critical of progressive politicians who say, well, welcome these people in.
Yes, that's why this book is coming in for so much stick. Most fiction writers have concentrated on the experience of the immigrant, and I think there are good reasons for that besides the political ones. The immigrant is disadvantaged, has many obstacles to overcome, is on a quest, you know, which in some people claim that all of fiction reduces to the quest, whereas the host population is just sitting there. Nobody's on a journey, and doesn't on the face of it seem in narrative terms to be as sympathetic. But I am very sympathetic with the experience of Western populations who have had massive numbers of people from elsewhere, often from very different cultures, imposed on them without electoral consent. And I believe that these people deserve to be heard and their concerns aired, and those concerns are aired in this book without apology.
You give them a voice, in other words, but you've been careful not to say it's a satire. Some people say, oh, look, this is a satire. It's taking the mickey out of this New York mayor's proposal and what the consequences could have been.
I'm disconcerted by that categorization because satire usually involves exaggeration for political effect. Right, to make a point. And you'll often reduce your characters to mere positions. Whereas this novel is perfectly realistic. There's nothing that happens in the book that couldn't happen in real life. In fact, it resembles what UK police call cuckooing, which is a real problem of criminals taking over the house of somebody who's probably elderly or otherwise vulnerable and using it as a base of operations.
I guess the reason people might criticise that is they say, well, look, of course there will be some in the immigrant population, some in the asylum seeker population who behave this way. But the danger is you're suggesting it is representative. It is typical.
Well, it deserves to be represented, even if it's not representative of all asylum seekers. The UK knows more than anybody that a proportion of asylum seekers are a threat to the community.
Deserves to, because that voice is worth hearing, you think. Now, that partly reflects your own attitude, didn't it? Although you're an American, you lived in the UK for, what, well over three decades, but then chose to leave quite recently.
Yes, I did. And I confess I miss my friends here a little bit, but I come back just often enough that honestly, you know how London social circles work. I probably see my friends more frequently visiting from Portugal.
But the reason I ask you about it is it suggests, and I don't know, we don't know each other, that you left in part because of immigration, because of your feeling that this wasn't the city that once had been.
That was misreported in a profile of me, that that's the sole reason that I left. And that certainly was a very small ingredient. It was out of wanting to make a change in my own life. And also, I have to confess, I was a little dismal about what was happening in this country.
But finally, you want people who even do disagree with the premise of this. You think they have something to get from this novel, do they? Rather than just people picking it up and going, yeah, these are my views.
Well, my experience with the progressive reader is that they cannot bear reading anything that they disagree with. So while I think that anyone of all persuasions would enjoy reading this book because I think it's better categorized as a thriller. It's a page-turner.
A morality tale?
I think it could pass for a morality tale, which isn't too preachy. But I think the progressive readers are probably going to be turned off.
There we are. It's not often you get a novelist coming on saying you might not like this book, but you've been very open about it. Lionel Shriver.